Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with Wendell Young, president of UFCW Local 1776, about the privatization of the state wine and spirit shops, because the governor, I guess he's flip-flop, changed his mind. We're going to do it because it's not a core function of government. We're going to move forward. We'll talk about that. I'm kind of baffled here that now it's urgent. We gotta go forward. Gotta go. In the second hour, we're gonna talk with Sarah Bigney. She's a mobilizer with the Maine AFL-CIO. I'm gonna talk about their governor who, you know, for some odd reason, the guy who as a kid beat up other kids and stole their candy, now wants to throw away the mural of the working people, of the history of the working people there in Maine. So that should be a lively discussion. Also, Professor Paul Quinn from Kutztown University in the second hour. Going to talk about the rally that was on Kutztown's campus today and what massive budget cuts are going to mean to the kids that are in school today and in the coming years, what this is going to mean to our state. And in the third hour, Will O'Neill from Walmart Watch going to be here talking about the Supreme Court case that was heard today. Get some early impressions on where he thinks the court may go and maybe talk about the case overall. I don't know if you saw this today. Sam Smith, the Speaker of the House here in Pennsylvania, he says he wants to have 50 fewer members in the House 10 years from now. He has introduced House Bill 153 to amend the state constitution to cut the 203-member House down to 153 members. And I love his rationale. He thinks that downsizing the House will make it work more efficiently. He says, it became pretty clear to me, regardless of the issue, the ability to build consensus was somewhat exacerbated by the fact that there were 203 people. I've got a better idea, Sam. The heck with the 153. Just do like they did in Wisconsin. Just go down to one. All we need is one, because that's how you guys run things anyway. You don't need consensus. You don't need to follow the rule of law. All you need is one. Just one. We can have a king. Wouldn't that be great? We wouldn't have to bicker. We wouldn't have to worry about this whole messy democracy stuff. We wouldn't have to have conversations. We wouldn't have to have free speech. We wouldn't even have to talk to each other. We could just walk in a straight line to our machines and spend all of our lives working at the machines like good little worker bees and never ask a question, never have our voices heard, never bother, because you guys are so much higher above us. You know, you guys know how to run things. Now, personally, I think this is a horrible idea, probably one of the dumbest ideas the Republicans have come up with yet for us. For them, obviously, it's a cost-saving measure for corporate America, because the fewer representatives, the fewer members that they have to lobby, the lower their lobbyist costs go, the lower their bribes have to go, the lower their, it's good for corporate America. It's good for the bottom line, good for the shareholders, good for the CEOs, more bonuses to go around if they only have to buy 153. So, another one of those really, really stupid ideas from our friends on the right. And speaking of Wisconsin, a letter came out this week, a fundraising letter, because the Republicans there in Wisconsin are getting thumped, and they know they're getting thumped. Eight of them are up for recall. They're probably going to recall at least four or five of them. And I'm hoping they go for all eight of them. But if you remember right at the beginning, they said, you know what, we need this budget repair bill. We just need to have this budget repair bill because our budget is so badly broken that we just need to repair it, which is the name, budget repair bill. And people bought into it. Yeah, we need to repair the budget. I hope nobody would notice. They tucked a whole bunch of stuff in there. A whole bunch of privatization, a whole bunch of tax cuts, a whole bunch of programs being cut, health insurance being ripped away from farmers. But they didn't want you to see that. We need to fix the budget. Shared sacrifice. Got to have it. Now, the state Senate Majority Leader Fitzy, Scott Fitzgerald, he put out this letter. And in the letter, he says, unions have ruined California and Illinois, but they're not going to ruin Wisconsin. That's because Republicans faced down big labor's bully tactics and a Democratic walkout in the Senate to break powers of the unions like WEAC and AFSCME once and for all. Now, am I the only one who remembers the rhetoric of people like Fitzy? Remember it was the budget repair bill. Remember him saying, today's passage of this momentous step towards getting our state fiscal house in order. Remember that? I know the people of Wisconsin do. And by him coming out and saying, look, yeah, now in their fundraising letter, yeah, we're gonna steal their rights away. You got to give them credit on one vein. They're almost honest. You look at states like Ohio, now Oklahoma, 37 states across this country are working to take collective bargaining rights away. Why? You've got Jim DeMint on the federal level saying he doesn't believe collective bargaining has any place in government, including the federal level. Because why should those people who are doing the jobs that we ask them to do have any voice, have any say in what goes on? Why should they? Understand the world that they want to take us back to, folks. Understand the world where we're going. That world is back to the 1880s, 1890s. And if you go to our Facebook page, there's a video clip on there about collective bargaining with regards to the Cumberland County Democratic and Republican commissioners who went to some twisted, bizarre 9-12 meeting. And they were asked about collective bargaining. Listen to their responses. If you work for a living, collective bargaining makes your life better whether you are a member of a union or not. Understand that somebody has a say in what's going on is a huge benefit for everybody. And right down the line, the Republicans were against you having the right to have say in anything. And, you know, it boggles my mind. And I would love to have some working class Republicans who say that ending collective bargaining, ending unionism is a good thing. I would love to have you call me, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, because maybe I'm just not getting it. Maybe I'm not seeing it through your eyes. Maybe I'm just missing it. Anyway, Ohio today, the House committee passed their bill restricting collective bargaining, so about 350,000 public employees are going to be banned from striking and have their rights stolen from them. The one version just took out the jail part. So, you know, if the people go on strike, they're just not going to throw them in jail. They'll fine them and they'll do a whole bunch of other stuff. They just won't throw them in jail, which is kind of nice of them, especially since most of those public sector workers work in the jails. It'd be kind of hard, but interesting times nonetheless. Anyway, I want to get to Tom Corbett because our next guest is Wendell Young. I want to lay a little background on this. This idea of there's no core government function with controlling how alcohol is distributed in this, which I'm calling a dangerous drug. Corbett was at the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania meeting right here in Harrisburg yesterday. And he said he wanted lawmakers to pass this legislation this year, basically hocking off our state stores to private operators because they're not a core function of government. This was in the Trib Review today. Hours after Corbett spoke, they had Wendell Young answer the question. And he told the Pennsylvania Press Club here that privatization would result in reduction in tax collections, which we know it will, and that wine sales would have to increase by 25%. And, you know, you stop and you look at what's going on. Do we really need more liquor in people's hands? I don't know. But Corbett has taken this bizarre position that, and it's kind of interesting if you think about it. He says that selling liquor and wine through state-run stores is a conflict of interest because the state enforces liquor violations. I can think of a number of things where the state provides a service where there's oversight of that service. Should we be providing a service for the elderly when there's a state agency that makes sure that the elderly are taken care of? Should we provide a service for children when there's an agency that oversees the care of children? Should we be overseeing the military? Should there be anybody watching over them? Since evidently we don't have the ability to watch over the people who are selling a dangerous drug and enforce the laws. That really, really is a murky line. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out as we go down the line. Now, Corbett says he's going to have this analysis done and what revenue would come in from selling the state stores. And I'm saying, what's the point of doing the analysis? What's the point? It sounds like you've made up your mind. Why waste the money? Just go ahead and do it. Now, Corbett's press secretary, Kevin Harley, said the study by the Pennsylvania financial management people will be done by mid-July. And I'm going, again, why bother? Why bother at all? It just doesn't make any sense to me, Jake. Why bother with wasting the money if you've already made up your mind? And it sounds to me like Corbett's already made up his mind.
Well, I think one thing he's not mentioning when he talks about oversight, from what I understand, Rick, as of now, the state police, I believe, have oversight responsibility because it's a tie-in with the state. If you go privatization route, those associated problems are going to be put back on the local level, which what does it mean? I mean, let's be honest. There's going to be less enforcement of the law. There's going to be more violation of the law, and the public is going to be put at risk. He doesn't mention that. But that is a real, very real possibility if they privatize.
Yeah, I mean, this whole idea, and again, it comes down to some common sense. It really does. It comes down to some common sense. I go back to when I was a kid growing up in Cleveland. Alcohol was available. Now, the hard stuff, anything over 42 proof, that was run by the state stores, and you had to actually go into one of those stores, and it was impossible to get anything out of there. But you go to the 7-Eleven and get anything under 42 proof, they're at the 7-Eleven, they're at the convenience stores, right there on the shelf next to the Tic Tacs. So at 15, 14, 15, we were going in, we were buying this stuff. And 42 proof is just as lethal as 80 proof when you're 14 or 15. And, you know, as a parent, and I go back to this quite often, as a parent, do I really want this? And the answer is no. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break right back after this with Wendell Young, president of UFCW 1776. Back after this. We want the world.
The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. March 25th saw the 100th anniversary of the tragic Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. On that date in 1911, the factory, located in New York City, resulted in the deaths of 146 garment workers. The employees had been locked inside the building by management, so they couldn't leave before the end of their shifts. As a result, when the fire started, few could escape, and many jumped to their deaths. On Friday in New York City, a memorial service was held which saw thousands of New Yorkers gather to pay their respects. Workers United President Bruce Rayner was one of those that spoke at the memorial. He wore a pin on his jacket that called for solidarity with Wisconsin workers, who are watching as Republican Governor Scott Walker strips their collective bargaining rights.
If you look up at those windows and see the purple banners, those were the windows out of which dozens of young women garment workers ages 14 to 25 were forced to jump out of those windows and be crushed to death on the sidewalk. We honor their memory, as we have been doing for generations at this spot every year.
Some of those that died in the fire were as young as 14. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire resulted in a new fight for workplace safety laws and child labor laws. New York Senator Chuck Schumer spoke about the new era that arose after the fire.
The Phoenix that rose out of the ashes of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire was a clarion call to action. It supercharged the American labor movement and emboldened activists and lawmakers alike to push forward with landmark workplace safety laws, child labor laws, and most of all, collective bargaining rights.
Throughout the country, during the last half of March, events have been held commemorating the tragic fire. In Washington, D.C., on March 21st, a symposium was held to talk about the fire and its aftermath. Panelist and author Kristen Downey explained how people found their voices after the fire, but how we've seemed to have lost our voices in this new century.
You only need 50 people working together to make anything happen. 50 people harnessed together. I mean, how many do we have in this room right now? Like, we've got like 80 here at least. You know, surely within us there are 50 people who can make some things happen. I think that's what Francis Perkins would say.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're a proud defender of a working class majority. Rick Smith.
You know, I look back at this, and I got to be honest, it's frustrating. Frustrating on a number of levels that, you know, originally they said $2 billion, and everyone going, yay, $2 billion. And then they said, well, maybe not. Maybe 1.7, maybe 1.5, maybe 1, maybe we don't know. We're going to do a study, and that'll be who knows how long. Now there seems to be some urgency of selling off the wine and spirit shop, again, hocking off state assets, hocking off that is, of which is ours, the commons. And to be honest, right now is not the time to be selling off state assets, considering we're still in a downturn, folks. It seems to me it would be a fire sale more than it would be anything else. And this idea of core government function, just absolutely laughable. Just insane. Anyway, this whole issue, the best person to talk about this is Wendell Young. He's the president of UFCW 1776 in Philadelphia and across this region as well. Wendell, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for inviting me to come on and talk about it. How you doing?
I'm good. You know, I look at this, and the governor says that selling liquor and wine through state-run retail stores is a conflict of interest because the state enforces liquor violations. That seems kind of dumb to me.
Well, you know, there's a lot of dumb things that have been said about this, and I was listening to your lead into this, and you're right. What got everybody whipped up into a frenzy is the idea that there was a $2 billion, billion with a B, pot of gold, windfall for the state if we were to auction off licenses. Well, you know, that's been proved to be wrong. In fact, Representative Mike Terzai, who's the leader in the House who launched this last fall, never even bothered to do any homework on this. He simply took a conservative think tank policy brief on the issue and a few other misguided facts from those who also didn't study it and came up with this notion that you get $2 billion when any 10-year-old could do a simple Google search and find out that liquor licenses of these types in surrounding states, border states, as well as from coast to coast, sell on average for about $200,000. So that would be about $170 million. Now, I admit that some pricey locations. It'll go for more than $200,000 here in Pennsylvania. And, you know, I would agree that it would probably fetch around $300 to $400 million at auction. However, we've taken a half a billion every year, $500 million, and that's an amount of money that continues to grow in taxes and profits. So that number will continue to go up. So I don't think the one-time influx of $300 to $400 million to lose a steady revenue stream on a system that has no debt, pays all its expenses, is a terrific asset. And to back up the point that you were saying about hocking off assets, I mean, this is not a part of government that's losing money. This is a part of government that actually works well, where government does a great job. It produces really good money. And here's a couple stats, just 3 points I'd like to make.
Okay.
Alcohol, by its very nature, causes some percentage of problems based on use, right? There's a lot of responsible drinkers, but some percentage of people have problems. So keeping that in mind, Pennsylvania generates, from a money point of view, because it's money that got everybody excited, the second largest amount of, the second most amount of money per gallon of wine and spirits sold in the nation. Second only to you, which has a system very similar to ours, and we're very close to them. We have one of the lowest, not the lowest, but one of the lowest consumption of wine and spirits per person. So we're generating amongst the most amount of money. We consume amongst the lowest amount of those products. And we have the lowest alcohol death, related death rate in the nation. This is a system that works. It works for all Pennsylvanians. Over 40% of Pennsylvanians' adults do not drink. For those who do drink and use the system, 86% of them like the service selection. They like the system. And all Pennsylvanians, whether a drinker or not, benefit from that revenue and from the lower cost impacts of the societal effects of alcohol. Why would you possibly even think about selling this?
Well, I mean, everything you've laid out, I got to ask why it's still very popular in the polling. Is it that there the
it's
information...
not popular in the polling, and I get really ticked off when people point to, for example, the Quinnipiac poll or the recent Muhlenberg poll that are both very similar. In the upper 60 percentile, voters say that they would support selling it. Here's why. First of all, they're knowledgeable, experienced pollsters, and they know on a complex issue like this, you have to ask more than one or two questions. Both polls were done the same way. There were a lot of questions related to state budget. The lead into the poll explained that there's a $4 billion, to the respondents, it was explained that there's this $4 billion deficit. And the question relative to state store privatization, I don't call them state stores, but that's what they call them. They're wine and spirit shops, was in both polls read like this. In order to balance the budget, would you support selling the state stores? So I'm not at all surprised that 60-some percent of the people in both polls, because they thought, said that, because they thought that by doing that, you'd raise $4 billion to $5 billion to balance the budget. The fact is, there's not a shred of evidence anywhere that suggests you can raise $1 billion or $4 billion or $5 billion. So they're very misleading questions. We did an internal study to ask people after saying, look, those who want to privatize say it can raise $2 billion. Those who are opposed to it say it might only be a couple hundred million and there's these other problems. And in that poll, less than 50% of the people wanted to privatize, only a little more than 40%. After they learned, well, there's a little more to the story. So these are experienced pollsters that know that that's not a credible poll. But, you know, you have to really dig into who's paying for the poll, what's the real purpose of the poll, you know, how detailed was it. The real poll, when you ask people in a survey who actually shop in the stores, what do they think of them? 86% responded in a recent poll that they like the stores, they like the service, they like the selection.
Yeah, I'm one of those, to be honest. You said that we have the lowest alcohol-related deaths in the country.
Yep.
Are there any studies out there? Is there anything out there that would say if we did privatize, are there any situations where this privatization has happened where you've seen that rate go up?
Absolutely. In fact, all of the science on this issue, and I'm very carefully using the term science because there are people who produce things that are that they call studies that are really policy briefs and they're not studies. Those scientists, the actual scientists that have been doing this research, and there's dozens of them over, you know, dozens of years, have been doing this research here in the United States, systems that are private versus systems that are not, systems that were controlled and went private here, Canada, and in Europe. Overwhelmingly, every independent, scientifically researched, peer-reviewed, peer-published study says that control states like Pennsylvania do a much better job and by a large margin a better job, that it is costly to privatize. You can look at the last two states to privatize, Iowa and West Virginia, Iowa in 1983, West Virginia in 1991. The revenue projections at the selling off of the licenses never came close to what was projected by the conservatives who pushed those drives, those privatization drives. The annual revenue plummeted. Iowa, it took 16 years before Iowa reached the level of revenue for the state that they were achieving under a control system after they privatized. And I would argue that based on the time value of the dollar, in other words, adjusted for value of the dollar over those 16 years, and the losses that they achieved, that they realized during those 16 years, that to this day Iowa still hasn't recovered. Treasurer Rob McCord featured West Virginia's privatization experience in his last quarterly newsletter, and he showed a chart that very clearly illustrates that in West Virginia, they didn't receive what they anticipated in licenses. In fact, it was such a botched experience for them that they had to go back three times to redo the auctions. They had to do three phases of auctions to try and convince operators to buy licenses and try and gin up the price. And in the end result is there's still five counties to this day after all those years that have no liquor stores at all because no one would even invest in a license in those rural counties. Pennsylvania wouldn't be any different. And in West Virginia, the revenue also plummeted. And they to this day haven't recovered from the cost of the privatization. So, you know, this idea that privatization is going to generate more money, we've already seen what's happened. Look what's happened in Canada. Just this January, University of Alberta released a study, a seven-year study of what happened to British Columbia when some communities privatized and some didn't. They were able to go in and compare the results adjusted for demographics and some other variables that scientists need to adjust for. What it shows is more people died of alcohol-related diseases, more additional other societal impacts. It costs the communities more money to deal with all those issues from a health and criminal justice point of view. And there are other studies that have been done that showed that selection dropped where privatization has occurred. Prices went up. So this idea that it'll be better in the private sector, that selection will improve, prices will get better, doesn't happen. Go to West Virginia. Again, you have less selection and higher pricing because most of the licenses were bought by convenience stores and drug stores, and they just don't plain old have much space. They only rearranged a little bit of their shelf space, and they charge huge convenience pricing. And that's pretty much the story around the country where privatization occurred.
So it'll be just another item on the shelf next to the Tic Tacs. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Wendell Young, president of UFCW 1776. The big question, the fact that you represent workers, I gotta ask the question, what is hocking these off do to your workers, the people that you represent?
Well, you know, the UFCW represents about 3,500 people statewide that work in the stores. There's a total of 5,700 people. 5,700 people that work in the system, union and non-union, between AFSCME, the managers' union, our union, and the management people of the system. And at a time where our state, like all states in our country, need jobs, and politicians talk about we need more jobs, we need better jobs, for some reason, you know, in this state, Tom Corbett still goes out day after day, and Mike Terzai making speeches about getting rid of nearly 6,000 decent jobs. Now, that's not just the impact on those families and those individuals. There's a multiplier effect that jobs create in the economy. You know, every job, especially a decent job that has, you know, good benefits and a decent income, that money percolates and gets respent within the local economy. So it multiplies. They call it the multiplier effect. So you end up creating a negative multiplier effect. So even if you get a couple hundred million by selling the auctions, by auctioning the licenses, when you add to that the negative multiplier effect, the cost of the unemployment benefits you're going to pay, other impacts on the state budget as a result of it, you start off with a negative number from day one.
Yeah, I agree. But here's my problem with it. Personally, you know, and I understand it from the jobs point of view. The Republicans ran in November. They were going to be the creators of jobs. Yet every time I hear them open their mouth, Corbett wants to cut 1,500 state workers. He wants to privatize the wine and spirits shops, doing away with a bunch of workers there. There's no creation there. All it seems to be is destruction. But for me, it comes down to, you know, and this may be hypocritical, but when I was a kid growing up in Cleveland, 42 proof alcohol was very available. It was next to the Tic Tacs at the convenience store. It was something that you could grab at 14 and 15. And I don't want my kids having that option.
Well, listen, you raise a good point. I was just looking at a letter that was published. I'm not sure what day it was published. I'm a little, I don't see the date on it. But from an owner here in Montgomery County, gentleman that owns several, convenience stores. And I'm just looking at it. It was published in the Time, the Reporter Online here in Montgomery County. And this guy's name, I'm just looking for his name right now real quick. I'm having a hard time finding it. Sam Tadakian. He writes a very good letter about what you just said and how he and his family have worked to create a handful of stores in Bucks in Montgomery County. And, they've been 37 years in the area, and they think they've worked to improve the neighborhoods. They took porn out of the stores when they bought them. They don't carry a number of other products that the community doesn't want. He's worked in other states. His family's worked in other states. He has colleagues that operate in other states. You know, to stay competitive, he would be forced to obtain liquor licenses if possible. It would change the character of the stores and of his neighborhood. He talks about the kind of folks that get brought into stores like this, irritable, drunks, people with an attitude. More crime occurs in those stores. He has stores now that people feel safe about sending their kids down the couple of blocks to go pick up milk and eggs and things, and people will no longer do that with some of the folks that hang around stores like that. It's been studied in other states. The crime statistics go up, all kinds of issues. So he's against privatization, even though he's a retailer that could profit from it, because he's experienced it firsthand in other communities like you. That's why he wrote that letter. I've never met this person. I don't even know what stores he owns. I'm very curious. But just before you called, I'm looking over today's press clippings and came across that.
Yeah, I got to be honest. It may sound hypocritical, but it's, you know, once you become a parent, it kind of changes things a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And moving forward, I mean, you know, there's going to be this attack. It's coming. Everyone knows. Everyone's known for some time. How do people like me, how do our listeners, how do we stop this?
Well, the best way to stop it is to contact your legislator. And today it's so easy. I mean, if you've got an internet connection, just Google Pennsylvania General Assembly or Pennsylvania legislature. There's a really tool that the legislators set up. You know, you can, you know, search by alpha or by, you know, address, find out who your legislator is, click on it, call them, send them an email, write them a letter if you like, pop into their district offices. You don't need an appointment. And it doesn't really matter. It's nice if they're there and they talk to you, or you can schedule an appointment to come back and talk to them, but make sure you leave your name, who you are, where you live, that, you know, you really don't want this, that you like the fact that Pennsylvania, in this case, government does something really well, that it benefits all Pennsylvanians. And the reason this is happening, and this is what folks really need to think about, you know, it's not just here. We see what's going on in Wisconsin and Ohio and other places. These are all related. The people pushing these agendas are high net worth individuals. You know, in this country, 400 families own 50% of the wealth, and it's not enough for them. So they fund these conservative groups who back candidates and drive political agendas that say privatize everything you can so we can make a buck off of it, we can make more money. It says push everybody down to the lowest possible level of employment standards, of benefits, of pensions, of wages, because the more you push that wage standard down, the more money those people make. And we've seen this transition happen over the last 30 years, and it's going to continue to happen. It'll continue happening until and unless the regular people who need the jobs, who need better jobs, who need more jobs, wake up and start going and voting for candidates that really represent their interest and not the interest of those 400 families.
Last question I've got for you, you know, and look what's going on in Wisconsin and Ohio and New Hampshire, 37 states across the country moving toward stealing rights away from working people. What has to be done? Where do you see things moving here in the coming months, here, especially here in Pennsylvania?
Well, in Pennsylvania, I think we've done some things in the past couple of years to you know, bring a little more awareness to those who are conservative but not radical extremists like the teabaggers in some of the recent elections that have come into the legislature. So I don't think we have enough of that element in Pennsylvania to tip things like we've seen going on in Ohio and Wisconsin, although I'm not going to take it for granted. I think we have to be very guarded. So the public employees here in partnership with the public employee unions, with the private sector unions, have launched, even last year before the elections, a group called the CLEAR Coalition. There's additional efforts through the AFL-CIO and through the major international unions to help bring resources into the states so that we can guard against that, make sure people have a better understanding under the dome and the legislature about, you know, these issues. And I think we were better positioned here in Pennsylvania, but the efforts there, they're definitely trying. There's a set of bills in Harrisburg that does all that same nasty stuff. You know, I think what happened in Wisconsin, the bad thing is it happened in Wisconsin. The good thing is it was a wake-up call. You see what the polls are not only in Wisconsin but around the country. You know, 70% or more of the people think that it was too much, it was overkill, it was unnecessary, it was wrong. And I think that's given pause to some of the more moderate folks in our legislature. And I think even pause to our governor about, I'm not sure I want to go there.
Yeah. And I believe that you guys have a rally coming up on May 3rd, the CLEAR Coalition, May 3rd, 1 to 2 p.m. here in Harrisburg.
We do.
At the state capitol. So everybody come on out and have your voices heard. And we'll maybe be able to see Wendell speak or say something as we move forward. Wendell, I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks, Rick.
Have a great night. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
If they slashed our funding, they cut all our hours, a Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a problem? How did the fall become all mine? The president says, the tithing and filth, the only one that's tithing is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
The corporate chieftains who have relentlessly pushed American factories and our middle-class jobs offshore rationalize this globalization of production by declaring that it's all about efficiency, as though that's the highest value to which a civilization can aspire. Values aside, however, the problem with corporate efficiencies is that too often they are not. Not efficient, that is. This is because the corporate scheme of moving stuff from A to B to G to Y in order to achieve the narrow goal of maximizing profits can look so simple, sensible, and even slick in a boardroom PowerPoint presentation, largely because it ignores inconvenient realities, such as earthquakes, tsunamis, and nuclear meltdowns. For example, Shreveport, Louisiana has been jolted by the horrific 1-2-3 blow that has pummeled Japan. What hit Shreveport was not a seismic aftershock, but the inherent fragility of the distant supplier networks built by profiteering globalizers. A GM truck plant in this city has had to shut down because one truck part made at a factory in the devastated area of Japan is not presently available. One. Amazing. Cars and trucks have about 20,000 parts, but the inability to get even a single one delivered from abroad can bring an entire assembly line to a halt. GM's bean counters had decided at some point that they could have this gizmo made in and shipped from Japan a bit cheaper than making it here. So GM and other globalizers have made themselves and us dependent on an unreliable, far-flung network of foreign factories.
Moreover, these scattered suppliers also are at the mercy of their suppliers. A plastic gadget maker in Japan, for example, might rely on a Chinese plant for the chemical to make the plastic. This is Jim Hightower saying, the efficiency of globalization is nothing but a cross-your-fingers fantasy.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Time to rearrange. Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show. You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say
revolution starts now. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, I look at this whole scenario, this whole hocking off of the state stores, and really the idea of fire sailing all the assets that the state has, because, you know, according to them, you know, the core functions of government, we keep hearing that over and over again. And, you know, what exactly does that mean? Can we outsource a whole bus stop? And then what does that mean for the people who need those services? The people who take care of children, the people who take care of senior citizens, the schools. You know, could we privatize all of that? Well, they're moving towards that. And the idea here is cut as many jobs, act like business. And you remember that whole discussion during election? Well, I don't know, it was really a discussion. It was more of just a slogan that they kept throwing out at us that I don't think people really understood what acting like a business, like running a government like a business means. It means slashing down to the bone and deeper to turn a profit. It means hooray for me and the heck with you. And that works, sort of, in the private sector where those services are give or take. You don't really need them. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. When you're talking about people's lives, when you're talking about the lives of children and seniors, and you're talking about fire and police and plowing the roads and doing all of the things that government does, sometimes you're not going to turn a profit. You're doing it for the public good. And that's what frustrates me, Jake. You know, I look at this and you've got these people who just, they've got their heads in the sand.
One part of this equation, Rick, which is really missing. You were, I don't know, I don't think you were around in the, you may have still been in Pennsylvania in the 90s, early 90s when they, the last time I remember the argument. And the Mad Mothers came out. And they went up on the hill and they were very, very effective. I do not hear that argument all that often, but it is indeed a key part of this whole situation. As a society, do we have a responsibility to protect those most vulnerable? I think so. When people get drunk and they start driving and they kill innocent people, who do we hold responsible other than the people that get drunk? If those people in fact get drunk and perhaps are underaged because we have a lax system, who's going to answer for that? And it will happen, you can bet. Those who want to sell, the state liquor stores talk about selling to mom-and-pop stores. Do you really believe that those mom-and-pop stores, first of all, they're not going to offer the variety that the state stores do. Second of all, you're not going to have the guarantees of not selling to underage drinkers. You know that's going to happen.
Well, here's the thing. For me, variety doesn't really matter. And that's that's one of those throw-out points. It's a nice thing to have a little choice. To be honest, I drink a couple of things. You know, I drink Tanqueray. As long as you got Tanqueray, we're okay. And Crown Royal. Okay.
No, but
those are two things that I drink.
There are people who do complain about that.
Yeah,
and
very, very small number of people.
Well, but the truth is, they offer. I mean,
You look at the place.
3,500. 3,500 different.
You look at the place down the road here. An amazing choice of products, if that's what you're into.
Oh, and by the way, if they don't have it, they will get it for you.
Just seems like a dumb idea to me. But all we keep talking about is how do we slash employment? If you're going to run thing government like a business, that means cutting more jobs. That means having a workforce that's overburdened, a workforce that's working harder, longer, for less. And that means trouble, I think, for society. And you look at all of these jobs that Tom Corbett wants to cut, 1,500 in the budget he talked about. They're talking about, you know, this. Look, if you think these wine and spirit jobs are going to turn into private sector wine and spirit jobs, it's not going to happen. This stuff's going to end up in a grocery store or in a convenience store. It's not going to end up in antique shops, maybe a handful. But the majority of the stuff is going to be in the supermarket. So what happens to those people once they lose those jobs? And those are decent jobs. They're not great, but they're decent. What happens to them? We end up on unemployment. And Joshua Holland over at Alternate wrote a nice piece, 8 unemployed for every job opening. What are they supposed to do once the benefits run out? And he talks a little bit about the 99ers, the folks who have seen all of their benefits run completely out. He writes, according to the National Employment Law Center, NELP, there are almost 14.5 million unemployed people in this country. People who want jobs can't find jobs. Picture, and he gives this image, picture people standing shoulder to shoulder from Bangor, Maine to Los Angeles, California, shoulder to shoulder all the way across the country and then back. That is what our unemployment situation looks like. And it looks like, you know, a mad problem. The problem is we've shoved that into the shadows. We've closed all those unemployment offices because we don't want to see them. Now, back in February, the average length of joblessness for the unemployed was a record 36 weeks. According to NELP, there were nearly 4 million 99ers last year, and they project a similar number this year. 4 million people beyond 99 weeks. And it's amazing. He goes through some people that he talked to. This Mike Thornton, who's a writer and activist. He runs the website Layoff List, who said it's pretty tragic out there for a lot of people. The long-term unemployed are discriminated against for being long-term unemployed. And the truth of the matter is, if you've been unemployed for 20, 30, 40, 50, 99 weeks, if you go to an employer who looks at you and go, well, nobody else wanted you, why would I want you? So there's a problem here. And this is where I think, again, right from the beginning, Obama should have created a jobs program on the scale of the WPA or the CCC to get people back to work, to give the ability to put something on their resume. That should have happened. He goes on to write, employers are hesitant to hire those who have been out of work for a lengthy period of time. Just like I said, because there are 5 people out there for every one job. And if you take this part-time employment and you throw that all into, it's an 8-to-1 ratio. Our friend John Dodge, director of the Philadelphia Unemployment Project, was quoted as saying, there are a lot of self-esteem issues there as well. There are obviously issues of maintaining the basic necessities. People are losing their homes. It's a very depressing situation for the long-term unemployed. They have to worry about their benefits running out, and many of them have. And, you know, that's one thing about unemployment. You don't end up getting health care. You don't get pensions. You don't get anything. You get sick, you are on your own, brother. And, you know, here in the state of Pennsylvania, we've got some unemployment compensation problems because we haven't recalculated unemployment for almost a quarter of a century. And what's frustrating is all you keep hearing is, well, there are jobs out there. Or this bizarre Horatio Alger statement. If I didn't have a job, I could find one tomorrow. Give it a try. Let me write you up a resume that says you've been off of work for 24 weeks. And let's see how well you do. The average length of unemployment for older workers, because older workers are the ones who have been hit by this. The average unemployment for those 55 to 64 is 44.1 weeks. Compared to that, to the 20 to 24-year-olds, who 30%. I'm struck by the numbers. Again, as we move down the road, you've got folks who are struggling. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Again, way over the time.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
I'm David Thill, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through attack shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Yeah, well, that's a big part of it, the greed. You look at Michigan, and I just want to finish this unemployment thing up real quick. You look at Michigan, they cut their jobless benefits by 6 weeks, so now it's down to 20 weeks. So, you know, a state that has one of the highest unemployment rates, that's what you're going to do to them. Amazing stuff. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Ike on line one. How are we doing tonight, Ike?
Hi, brother. You know, I'm trying to, it's a Republican world and it seems like I'm just renting space.
I hear you. I hear you.
You know, listen, we know the playbook. You know, anybody that's paid attention over since the 80s has watched these guys do what they do. This is no big mystery. It's no big surprise. You know, they do that lease, that sale leaseback garbage with public transportation. And, I mean, you know, they had the Enron fever there for a while, and they wanted to even bring, you know, private well water into the game. Anything that they can trade and anything that they can move as commodity, that's where it's at. Even if you've got to leverage yourself with used borrowed money or investors' money or wherever you pull that money from, you're basically, you know, you're playing a numbers game. And, you know, as long as the globalists are continued to be allowed to run rampage across the globe, which I think, honestly, I think a lot of that is a good sign in Egypt and the rest of these places. They're basically saying, even at their level, look, no more of this cheap labor, no more of this, no job, no this, no that, you know, we're going to take what's ours. And I keep telling you, man, I smell fascism. It's corporate fascism. No two ways about it. And this welfare deal, well, think about it. If you're running the jails with private contractors that are making money off of it or trying to, well, they got you coming and going.
Absolutely.
I'm going to be in the 99 weekers. You know, I see it coming. And, yeah, I'll probably have to go get a job flipping burgers or something.
If you'll be able to get that.
That's the sad thing.
I mean, that's the sad thing of this whole scenario. There aren't jobs out there, and you could say there just aren't minimum wage jobs out there either.
Well, not to mention I'm in that cursed group of the over 50 white male construction worker. And trust me, brother, the construction trades, me and you have gone around about that, too. And I don't understand. Trust me, brother. I have a hard time getting my head wrapped around the new normal where I've got to learn Spanish and I've got to be pushed out of my job because of, you know, open borders and illegal labor and cheap labor and the kind of flooding that's been done on the labor market.
And that has everything to do with the fact that you've got politicians in Washington and across this country who are encouraging this.
It's the oligarchs. Absolutely. They're all the same. That's why I keep saying the oligarchs are the politicians. The politicians serve the oligarchs.
Well, the politicians are just the pawns. The politicians are the pawns in this. They're the ones who are bought and paid for. Without the money from the big corporate donors, there are no politicians.
Exactly. And, you know, and so at this point, you know, the war that I've been waiting to come, you know, waiting to have open in this country for the last 20 years or 30 years, or at least some sign of life, protest, and that's what I mean when I say war. I don't mean physical war, destroying everything. I'm talking about people get off their haunches and get something moving and let's roll. You know, I keep waiting. I keep looking. I keep, you know, paying attention, and I don't see enough of a movement. Oh, by the way, let me plug one for you.
Go ahead.
The one that got started over in the UK, it's called Uncut UK.
Right.
Now it's here in America. It's called uncutamerica.com or .org or whatever. And they're basically going out to the banks of America in their own hometowns, and they're going out to financial centers, and, you know, they're protesting in front of the buildings. I mean, even at the grassroots level, small groups like that on the weekends or whenever we can get it together, we need to be doing it.
I think we've talked to somebody from their group, haven't we, Brett?
You might have been where I heard it, brother.
Yeah.
I'm plugged into a lot of talk radio because, you know, I not only want to hear all sides of it, but I want to hear different opinions from different parts of the country. And, oh, by the way, I did always have a hard time when I was in Pittsburgh the first 2 weeks. A buddy of mine, when we stopped to get gas, I'd walk through and make the circuit in the convenience store, and I'd walk back to the counter after about 2 weeks. He finally asked me, he said, why do you do that every time you go in the convenience store? I said, well, you know, I was thinking about maybe picking up a 6-pack or 12-pack or whatever. And he just started laughing his head off, and that's when I found out the system that you folks use up there.
Yep.
But I can tell you, and I can tell you this, yes, with privatization, you're going to have more DUIs, you're going to have more underage drinking, and you're going to have, the DUI part's the biggest part. I mean, you know, down south it's a whole different way of living, the same way out in Texas. I don't know if you still go through a drive-thru and get a daiquiri, but, you know, the views on drinking and driving in some places is a little different.
Yeah, in some places it's like a sport, not here.
Exactly.
When I was a kid, that's how it was. We, you know, there were those places where you could drive through and get one cold can of beer, and you weren't going to drive with it. And the idea was that you weren't going to drink and drive with it, but everybody knew
well,
how that went.
Well, I appreciate the job you guys are doing. I just, you know, by the way, if the fascism word makes them uncomfortable, I'm still going to call them Republic Guards.
There you go.
That's who they are, and that's who they serve.
Absolutely. Appreciate the call, brother.
All right, my friend.
Thanks so much. You know, look, at the end of this, it's going to come down to, like he says, people going to the streets. But I just don't think we're desperate enough. I don't think as a country we've gone down far enough. I think they will push us far enough. The more I look around, the more I observe, I think that they really think that they can push us all the way down. And that will be their undoing. Because then eventually we will spring back up. At least that's the hope. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Sarah Bigler, or Big Knee, from the Maine AFL-CIO. We're right back after this.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. March 25th saw the 100th anniversary of the tragic Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. On that date in 1911, the factory, located in New York City, resulted in the deaths of 146 garment workers. The employees had been locked inside the building by management, so they couldn't leave before the end of their shifts. As a result, when the fire started, few could escape, and many jumped to their deaths. On Friday, in New York City, a memorial service was held which saw thousands of New Yorkers gather to pay their respects. Workers United President Bruce Rayner was one of those that spoke at the memorial. He wore a pin on his jacket that called for solidarity with Wisconsin workers, who are watching as Republican Governor Scott Walker strips their collective bargaining rights.
If you look up at those windows and see the purple banners, those were the windows out of which dozens of young women garment workers ages 14 to 25 were forced to jump out of those windows and be crushed to death on the sidewalk. We honor their memory, as we have been doing for generations at this spot every year.
Some of those that died in the fire were as young as 14. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire resulted in a new fight for workplace safety laws and child labor laws. New York Senator Chuck Schumer spoke about the new era that arose after the fire.
The phoenix that rose out of the ashes of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire was a clarion call to action. It supercharged the American labor movement and emboldened activists and lawmakers alike to push forward with landmark workplace safety laws, child labor laws, and most of all, collective bargaining rights.
Throughout the country, during the last half of March, events have been held commemorating the tragic fire. In Washington, D.C., on March 21st, a symposium was held to talk about the fire and its aftermath. Panelist and author Kristen Downey explained how people found their voices after the fire, but how we've seemed to have lost our voices in this new century.
You only need 50 people working together to make anything happen. 50 people harnessed together. I mean, how many do we have in this room right now? Like, we've got like 80 here at least. You know, surely within us there are 50 people who can make some things happen. I think that's what Francis Perkins would say.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, our enemy seems to be all of these governors across the state, these Republican governors who, for some odd reason, they've all gotten the same playbook from the same think tank in Washington, who's told them that this is the way you go about it. You break the unions down, you steal from the workers, you basically privatize everything that the citizens own and give it to us, the very wealthy. And that's how you do it. And that seems to be the way they've been going. They've all had their own little unique way of doing it. Some, you know, very bold like Scott Walker, some, you know, not so bold like here, Tom Corporate. But some really, really petty. And I look at the guy in Maine, the guy who admitted as a kid beating up other kids stealing their candy, at Halloween, has decided that he's going to strip down this mural from their Department of Labor building. Again, really pretty petty stuff. That's why I've asked, Sarah Bigney from the Maine AFL-CIO to come talk to us a little bit. Sarah, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, no problem. Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this, and I got to be honest, it seems kind of petty to me.
It's an absolute insult to Maine workers and all of us here in the state.
You know, can you explain exactly what this mural was, where it was, what it meant, how it got there, that kind of stuff?
Sure. Yeah, it's a Maine workers working class history mural, and what it is, it's seven different panels. One depicts loggers. One is the shoe strike back in the 1930s. One depicts child labor. There's a whole series of different people and moments from Maine's history, and it was in the lobby entranceway of our Maine Department of Labor. It is no longer there because this weekend the governor's had it taken down while no one was watching.
I got to be honest. I read some of the stories, and his spokesperson said that they thought that by having this mural in the Department of Labor building, that it tilted the Department of Labor too far in the favor of labor. After all, it is the Department of Labor, which is kind of weird to me, that they would make this distinction. But do you have any thoughts on how bizarre that seems?
It's crazy. I mean, we're very disappointed, and people are just outraged across the state. People are incredibly upset. We've seen an outpouring of opposition and really bewilderment to the governor's action from everyone from business leaders to working people. Everyone said, I never had a problem with it. The one reason he said the governor cited, or his spokespeople cited, as why he needed to take this down was the anonymous letter he received that was signed by a secret admirer
that compared
the mural to something they would have in North Korea. And that's why we need to take the mural down. So it's just a really bizarre story, and we're disappointed that the governor's priorities are picking fights with working people instead of solving the problems that our economy is facing.
But what I said when I read the story yesterday, I said, well, he created one job, maybe two, for a couple of scabs who worked on a Sunday, I guess, because he did it over the weekend, right?
Right, over the weekend.
Kind of like
it was there Friday afternoon.
Kind of like it was in the night. They decided to, you know, create at least two jobs, I guess, to take this down out of the public view, which, again, to me, seems to be kind of a backdoor move.
Absolutely. You know, he's definitely got misplaced priorities about what he needs to be spending his time on. He is to appoint a commissioner of labor. It's the last cabinet position that hasn't been filled. And yet he's worried about interior decorating. You know, it's not about the mural. It's about a direct insult and, targeting of labor in Maine.
Gee, that sounds awful familiar, not having a Secretary of Labor. Do we have one, Jake? I don't think so. I don't think Tom Corporate has appointed one yet. Seems to be a Republican thing. You know, you bring up some interesting points on what the mural was. It talked about the history of the state. It talked about the history of workers. Do you think part of it has to do with taking that education component away, especially when you're talking about, like, child labor, because that's the direction we're going back toward?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we learned from our history, and we need to know that people fought for the things that we take for granted for today, you know, that we take for granted all the worker safety protections that came from tragedies like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, and that we outlawed child labor. And the irony is that this mural, on Friday when he announced that where the mural was to go, there was also a public hearing on a bill, or I guess it's a work session on a bill in the legislature to weaken our state's child labor laws. So clearly he did not get the message, did not spend some time looking at the mural and studying our history as a state. We're a working class state. Working people built this state, and he seems to be very out of touch with that.
Well, it sounds to me he's going to think, like, going back to his childhood, wants to beat those kids up again and steal their candy again.
Yeah.
In looking at this, do you think the voters of Maine are kind of having, I know here in Pennsylvania, most of the people I know are having some buyer's remorse. What kind of reaction are you seeing to folks up in Maine?
The reaction is widespread. People are very upset. People that, you know, may have not been following politics very closely are very angry. You know, we've been in towns that are generally more conservative or whatever, and people across the board are saying, wait a second, this is crossed the line. This shouldn't happen. You know, this is our history. When you look at that mural, most Maine families see their story in that, their grandparents' struggles, the way they were raised, you know, whether they're from a logging family or their parents worked in a shoe shop or whatever it may be. So people across the board are very angry about this in a way that we haven't seen the unity in opposition in a while.
Do we know what undisclosed location they moved the mural to?
Some sort of warehouse, apparently. But no, it's not. It hasn't been released where that is.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in Maine. I've spent a lot of time in Portland, Augusta, Bangor. And I got to be honest, I never really thought that the state was all that extreme as this guy is. How did he get elected?
Well, we're not all that extreme. He only got 38% of the vote. We had an independent candidate along with a Democratic and Republican candidate, so the vote was split very very evenly across three ways, and the winner was Mr. LePage. So a lot of people already... 62% of the public, you know, didn't want him on election day. And I think probably even fewer than the people that voted for him now are saying that they still support him. People are across the board very angry and upset that this is where he's trying to take our state.
For me, that situation is a perfect example for instant runoff voting, in my opinion.
Oh, sure. And a lot of people are talking about that. You know, I don't think we are going to be able to get that bill signed and off the governor's desk in the next 4 years, because he probably would not want to see that kind of legislation. But people are talking about that and trying to figure out how we can change our electoral system. But moreover, I think, you know, there's other reasons, too. And maybe the legislators, we had a lot of great pro-labor legislators, but we also had some, you know, Democrats who didn't really do a lot for working people in this state. And so maybe this is a wake-up call that some people needed. Unfortunately, it's going to do a lot of damage. But I think people are starting to see what the Republicans and the Tea Party candidates really are all about, because those guys are showing their true colors, and a lot of people are distancing themselves from that now that we're really seeing what they're all about.
As a mobilizer for the Maine AFL-CIO, are you seeing like a resurgence in membership, being aware of wanting to get out into the streets of participation?
Absolutely. And so even though this is sort of a disaster in our Blaine House where the governor lives, we are having, you know, huge involvement from our membership, people that have never gotten involved with politics before, and sort of not, you know, local unions that didn't really engage in different election cycles or different issues in the past are sending all kinds of members to the state house to lobby and to meetings to get updated on what's happening. We're having, it's really an organizer's dream, because people are getting involved like they never have before. So we're having fun. I gotta say that, you know, it's a great opportunity to get people out and trained on how to do this work, how to go and lobby your legislator, how to pay attention and do an in-district meeting or whatever. So people are definitely getting very involved. I guess when the target's on your back, we have a common enemy, so we're all coming together.
Yeah,
because the governor is trying to pass here in Maine the so-called right to work. We call it right to work for less legislation.
Right.
So we're in a major battle to defeat that bill, along with a whole host of other anti-worker, you know, bills that the governor is supporting. So we've got a lot on our plates, and this is just the latest in his anti-worker agenda.
Yeah, I think all of those bills, and there's a whole bunch of them here in our state house as well, here in Pennsylvania, you know, the right to work, do away with prevailing wage, do away with collective bargaining, do away with, you know, all of those protections that working people have fought, bled, and died for over the years. I personally think that they're not smart enough to write them up themselves. They've basically cut and paste them from their little think tanks in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know too much about what's going on nationally, but it's clear when you follow the money about who elected him, we see it was big corporations that donated a lot, and now are getting, you know, getting what they paid for.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the reason we do on this program. We've been talking to people from Wisconsin, from Illinois, from Indiana, you know, Ohio, across the country, Arkansas, now Maine, about the attacks that are going on, because I think people need to hear that this isn't just a localized crazy guy. This is a national. This is a concerted effort on the national level to really destroy workers' rights in this country.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we're so thankful that the people in Wisconsin stood up and said no more, because it really inspired a lot of people to get active and got the attention of people that were, you know, maybe concerned about what happened in Maine, but didn't know that it was a whole national effort and national attack. And our neighbors in New Hampshire are facing a lot of really bad legislation. So we know that it's happening there. And we definitely need to have some coordination with our brothers and sisters across the country so we can fight back together.
Yeah, New Hampshire was horrible, basically making them like Pennsylvania, right, an at-will state,
mm-hmm.
which is just horrible. I don't know how Maine is. Maine's not an at-will state, is it?
Well, we do not have right-to-work legislation now. I'm not exactly sure beyond that.
Well, at-will means I can fire you for any reason. I don't need any reason whatsoever to fire you if you don't have a union contract.
Oh, well, that's us too, yep.
See, again, you know, one of those things that people need to hear. Sarah Bigney, I appreciate your time. Last question, real quick. Did they figure out what they're going to rename the rooms in the Department of Labor that used to be named after labor leaders of the past?
No, we don't know what they'll be changing the Francis Perkins room to, or the Cesar Chavez room to, but they are having a contest, I read in a memo from the acting deputy commissioner to rename them, so people that work at the department are able to submit suggestions.
Yeah,
we'll see what happens with that.
I'd like to suggest a good, you know, fighter for workers, you know, the Koch brothers.
Yeah, maybe they'll get a room.
That
would be great.
The Koch room. Yeah, everyone go in there and get high and wide. Sarah Bigney, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you. Take care.
All right, Sarah, from the Maine AFL-CIO. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
It's a
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The corporate chieftains who have relentlessly pushed American factories and our middle-class jobs offshore rationalize this globalization of production by declaring that it's all about efficiency, as though that's the highest value to which a civilization can aspire. Values aside, however, the problem with corporate efficiencies is that too often they are not. Not efficient, that is. This is because the corporate scheme of moving stuff from A to B to G to Y in order to achieve the narrow goal of maximizing profits can look so simple, sensible, and even slick in a boardroom PowerPoint presentation, largely because it ignores inconvenient realities, such as earthquakes, tsunamis, and nuclear meltdowns. For example, Shreveport, Louisiana, has been jolted by the horrific 1-2-3 blow that has pummeled Japan. What hit Shreveport was not a seismic aftershock, but the inherent fragility of the distant supplier networks built by profiteering globalizers. A GM truck plant in this city has had to shut down because one truck part made at a factory in the devastated area of Japan is not presently available. One. Amazing. Cars and trucks have about 20,000 parts, but the inability to get even a single one delivered from abroad can bring an entire assembly line to a halt. GM's bean counters had decided at some point that they could have this gizmo made in and shipped from Japan a bit cheaper than making it here. So GM and other globalizers had made themselves and us dependent on an unreliable, far-flung network of foreign factories. Moreover, these scattered suppliers also are at the mercy of their suppliers. A plastic gadget maker in Japan, for example, might rely on a Chinese plant for the chemical to make the plastic. This is Jim Hightower saying, the efficiency of globalization is nothing but a cross-your-fingers fantasy.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.com.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Today, back in 1948, they had the Battle of Wall Street. That's right. You had a whole bunch of people laying down in front of the stock exchange doors. Hundreds and hundreds, thousands of people laying across the sidewalk in the Battle of Wall Street as police arrested strikers and basically hit them on the ground and stuff. And that was the Battle of Wall Street, people laying peacefully on the ground while police drugged them away and beat them with sticks. Somehow that was the battle. At least that's how they framed it. When I love how they, when we demand something, it's a battle, it's a fight. But when they do it, it's just a normal course of business. You look at the fact that GE pocketed more than $14 billion in pure profit last year, paid zero in taxes. Yet all we hear about is our high corporate tax rate. You know, we've got the highest corporate taxes in the world. And we hear our politicians saying, oh, we've got a spending problem. We need to cut spending. Cut spending. We have a spending problem. I don't think we have a spending problem. Could there be some areas where we could curb? Could there be some areas where we could use resources a little bit better? Absolutely. But I think we've got a major revenue problem, especially when you look at a company like GE. $14.2 billion pure profit, add another $3.2 billion in taxpayer handouts, and they still paid zero back? What happened to the share of sacrifice, Jake? What happened to all in this together? What happened to that?
All I can say is their legal department has paid off handsomely, hasn't it?
Their tax avoidance department has paid off handsomely.
Same thing.
And now you look at Bank of America, who got almost $1 billion from taxpayers all around the country. All we keep hearing are these right-wingers going nuts. You need to cut. And, you know, I heard it today. You know, we went to that rally and I heard people saying today, well, you know, they had one guy who was saying, well, you know, we're going to have to cut some programs, but it'll be okay. No, nonsense. You see these big corporations, like Bank of America, you see big corporations like GE paying nothing. I think there's a major problem there. And what I find interesting is, again, they paid no taxes, nothing, man. We're not getting anything back from them. You know, when we had corporate charters, they had to say how they were going to benefit society. How does GE benefit society when you're looking at the fact that they're cut, they want major concessions from their 15,000 unionized workers at a time when they're wildly profitable? How is that good for society?
It's not.
And as leaders of the, in this country, you know, you should have politicians standing up saying, you know what, I would be happy to cut spending and sacrifice and help out when they do. When everybody else is chipping in, you know, we've got a wealth class, and as Wendell Young said, 400 people own 50% of the wealth in the country. 400 people. We get 400 people into the, just into this studio and downstairs in our offices here. We probably get 400 people in here. They control half of the wealth of this country. So when you've got 400 people who own half of the wealth of the country, we're not broke. Because there are some revenue to be had.
Well, apparently a lot of people haven't figured it out. You know, the right wingers are good at saying, well, you know, you don't want to take the richest money away because they create wealth. They create wealth. They're good for the country. Well, here's the thing. The more you concentrate wealth, money controls, whether we admit it or not, whether we like it or not, the reality is that money controls the political process. So if the wealth is concentrated too heavily in the hands of too few, who have the political power to do what? To change the laws, which affect our very lives from the time we get up until the time we go to bed. To allow that to happen, not only will ultimately destroy the democratic process, it will reduce the standard of living for the rest of us. It's that simple.
Here's the problem. Pure and simple. This is the problem. If we're handing all of this wealth to the top 400, to the top 1,000, to the top 5,000. That means we're not investing in education. They're talking about cutting $1 billion from K-12. They're talking about cutting higher education by 56%. They're talking about creating a privatization scheme within K-12 education that will cost us another $1 billion in education. We're not investing in the future. And now you look at the story by out of Reuters that said the United States fell one spot to third in the clean energy investment race last year, as the lack of national energy policy hurt purchases in wind and solar power and other techniques, according to the report. China was first, Germany was second, and we were third, according to the report, who's winning the clean energy race that was published by the Pew Charitable Trust. Again, you know, you go back to this and you look at the reality that if we had over the years invested in the future, said, you know what, we're going to spend a little money today, it's going to save us in the future, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in now all around the world. I really believe that. And, again, we're very short-sighted as a society. We should be moving full steam ahead on how to be energy independent. And, yeah, right now we probably do need to do some offshore drilling just to get us over the hump. We do probably need to do a whole bunch of things that I don't like, and my tree hugger friends don't like, just to get off the foreign junk and to get us moving in the right direction. I don't have a problem with some of this other stuff, as long as we've got a plan that in 10, 15, 20 years, we are completely independent and dependent solely upon ourselves. Because that's the only way you can be powerful. That's the only way you're going to be able to remain the superpower. China is dependent on others for their power because they need the energy. We're dependent on others. And it just seems to me as a matter of common sense that we would say, no, I would like to be energy independent. I don't want to deal with the people in the sandbox. I don't want to deal with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. I don't want to deal with the Mexican cartels. Makes sense to me.
Well, I mean, let's be honest, of all the industries, I mean, it's probably a toss-up between who's the most powerful, the oil industry or the insurance companies, but over the years, the oil industry has done a masterful thing. I'm talking about the last 50. I'm not just talking about the last 20. I'm talking about the last 50. They bought up, what'd they do? They bought up all kinds of ideas that would have lessened our dependence on oil, patents. they were able, because of their huge profitability and their huge profits, they have been able to, on very many issues, buy Congress. And what does that mean? That means that we, because of that, instead of doing what we should do to get to remain energy independent, they have been able to persuade enough politicians that what we need to do is support oil's agenda. And here we are. Here we are. We should be energy independent if we would have just listened to Jimmy Carter. Just listened to some of the basic proposals. And Jimmy Carter wasn't suggesting that, we all give up our cars. He wasn't suggesting that somehow we dramatically change our society. He has just suggested that we start on the road back in the 70s. And if we would have followed his advice, where would we be today? A lot better off, I guarantee you.
Yep. Private investment in the U.S. in clean energy technology totaled $34 billion, according to the report. That was up 51% from the previous year. And you've got to give the Obama administration a little bit of credit. They did put some money into this, and it is moving in the right direction. But that pales in comparison to the nearly $55 billion invested by China and the more than $41 billion invested by the Germans. Now, Germany is a very small country. I don't know, not much bigger than many of our states. Yet they're investing almost well over $41 billion to be independent of everybody else. Sounds like somebody's got a plan. Anyway, for those of you who care, and I'm one of them, it appears the managers who were on board the Deepwater Horizon rig may be facing manslaughter charges over the deaths of the 11 workers in last year's disaster. According to Bloomberg News, people familiar with the matter say that, it's possible that there are possibility of charges. They also said that federal investigators were looking to whether or not executives with BP, like Tony Hayward, the former CEO, made false statements in their testimonies before Congress. This could be very interesting because, we always talk about that, the big fish always get away. It's the little guy who takes it on the chops, and, it goes so high and then it's cut off because those are the people to blame. Like this thing going on with the photos in Afghanistan, with these guys, these handful of a-holes who were doing these things. It's going to stop with them, maybe their commander. You're not going to tell me that this long of a period of time nobody else knew, but that's where it's going to stop.
Well, if you remember, and this is going back a little bit, but I do remember that, Derek. It was the parent company had subcontracted, brought in a company to oversee the project. They were given complete authority, if you remember that, Rick. And there's testimony now coming out that in the end, instead of following through the recommendations of the company which was hired to do the job to make more money, ultimately the decision was kicked upstairs, and those at the head of the country, including our friend, were part of the decision. And they said, forget about the company we hired. We're going to do what we have to do to make maximum profits, and you see what happened. They should be held criminally liable. And it's not just one or two people. It's not just the management people in that dairy. Oh, no. That decision was made from above.
Absolutely.
And we shall see who answers ultimately.
Yeah, we'll see. 1-888-520-RICK. We're going to come back with Pat Quinn, professor at Kutztown University, talk a little bit about the big rally today. If you want to take a look at the video of me giving my little minute speech over at the ricksmithshow.com. We're back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
PSECU, we know those holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer. Good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high interest rate balances to your PSECU Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing Lite is what we do best. Talk with us.
call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pscc.com/life to get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, that's what they're trying to do, and not only just for summer. There are those who want school to be out forever. That's the only rationale I can come up with. That's the only logical conclusion to all this, why you would cut 56% from higher education, is that you basically want to cut the number of people who are going. That's the only logical solution here. That you know, I'm not saying I'm a mind reader, but at some point, the facts are what they are. And today out at Kutztown University, we took the crew out there to witness the rally and to participate a little bit with the kids out there who are fighting for their futures. And as I said, look, I believe that what Corbett is doing is sentencing these kids to a death sentence, because, you know, for me to sacrifice a little bit now, it's going to hurt a little bit, but I'll get over it. But to cheat these children out of an education right now, these college kids right now, is going to sentence them to low-wage jobs far into the future. That's why I've asked one of the organizers, Professor Paul Quinn from Kutztown University, to come talk to us a little bit, fill us in on the details. Professor Quinn, welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to be on.
You know, I look at this, and it's infuriating on so many levels because, you know, I saw the faces of the kids that were out there today, and I probably shouldn't call them kids. They're young adults. I can't imagine.
They're like kids, right? I mean, it's like a giant family when you get to work with them all the time.
I can't imagine being the one to take their future away.
Oh, I can't either. I don't know what this governor thinks he's doing. You know, the fact that you would cut education while you're putting money into these other programs, you know, I mean, the whole reason we're in this mess is clearly people weren't educated on how to run a budget and how to run a state, and now we're going to cut education, which would actually help people get out of the mess we're in. And it makes no sense to me.
You know, I've taken the position that we don't have a spending problem. I keep hearing this frame by all the politicians, and it's infuriating because, you know, to be honest, the state hasn't really raised taxes in the last 20 years. We have a revenue problem. We have money fleeing this state through the Delaware loophole. We have money leaving this state because the people who are poking needles in our ground and stealing the natural resources from under our feet aren't paying their fair share. There are people, the cigar tax that isn't there, the smokeless tobacco tax that isn't there. There's all of this revenue going away, yet we're going to slash education.
I agree, and you also have a priority problem, right? I mean, even if you did have a spending problem, right, would you cut education, which is the thing that will get you out of the spending realm, right? And, you know, it just makes no sense at all. You know, there are other places that you can. I mean, talking about taxing the gas, right? And the governor, of course, says he won't tax the gas with the new Shell deposits or whatever because it's a new budding industry, right? Forget the fact that you got to educate people to know how to extract the stuff from the Shell, right? I mean, that doesn't matter. You know, it just, again, the guy doesn't know education. He's bought out by the people that got him into office. It's really a shame because, you know, the more you get into politics and look at this crap, the more you see this happening.
Do we really want people educated on how to negotiate the leases? You know, I was watching the hearing last night with some of the college presidents, and they were saying that, you know, the guy from Penn State was saying, you know, well, we help people, resident, you know, farmers and stuff, negotiate the leases with the drilling companies. And my first thought was, do the drilling companies really want them to know what's going on?
No, they probably don't. I mean, that's how you gain power, right? Is you keep the people undereducated, you keep them needing you, and then you control what they do. I mean, that's the strategy that's going on with these people in office right now. It's really sad.
So tell me this. Where's the plan from here? Today you had a couple hundred people come out and support the agenda, which is to restore the funding for education, not the 25%, not 10%, but to restore the funding levels. Because look, those kids that I was talking to today, they're $20, $25, $30,000 in debt going into a job market where basically, do you want fries with that as their only option?
Yeah, I think, and the plan right now is the ultimate goal is going to be another march to Harrisburg. And we'll have to go back to Harrisburg, and this time it's got to be more people. It's got to be longer, right? It's got to be louder. I mean, this is the kind of thing where, you know, that's what's going to really get their attention. So we'll have more rallies on campus, right? There'll be more of an education going on because you got to get more people involved. And we had a nice turnout today, but you have to have more because there was one of the speakers when we were in Harrisburg that said, you know, exactly what they're going to do. They're going to try to wait the kids out until they go home, right? And then they'll try to ramrod their agenda through. And we have to make a lot of noise, and we have to make a big difference to get this guy to actually listen and, you know, come to his senses before that happens. So, you know, I think the 14, you know, schools have to work together. There's been talks amongst the 14 schools, not just amongst faculty, really. This is very student-driven, which is fantastic, you know. If the faculty drive it, you know, it's the evil faculty trying to save their jobs. The fact that you got the students driving this and we're just in the background helping them out, that's what makes this a fantastic thing because the students are actually waking up and seeing that it's their future that's being compromised. So, you know, again, the ultimate goal is another trip to Harrisburg, more students, more buses, more noise, more, you know, more protesting and more getting the governor's attention because he has to answer for his irresponsible decisions.
You know, I say, and I've said this a number of times, the only way that things change is when people take to the Capitol here, they bring their sleeping bags, and they do like they did in Wisconsin. They hole up for a week, two, three, four, whatever it takes to get the attention of the people inside.
An old-fashioned sit-in, right, like they used to do back in the 70s and 60s. Yeah, I mean, you know, at this point, it was great to have the kids there, and the kids, you know, forced some of those legislators to answer questions and whatnot, but yeah, I agree. I mean, the kids got to get into that Capitol building. They got to be a constant presence there until the right thing is done. I agree with you.
You know, and then they need the support from people behind saying, here are the resources you need to be able to pull this off.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That's where, you know, at least from ABSCUS point of view, ABSCUS is supporting these kids and what they want to do. I mean, the buses yesterday, you know, they were paid for by ABSCUS. They were organized in conjunction with ABSCUS and the student government on campus. We've been working with the students, helping educate them, right? I mean, everything that the students did at the protest today was all stuff online. It's just a matter of showing them where to look online to find some of the facts. So,
yeah, I listened to the one guy speak, and he said, you know, we don't, these schools don't turn out hedge fund managers. They don't turn out CEOs. The schools that we're talking about, the 14 state institutions, they turn out teachers and accountants and people who do solid jobs, make a solid middle class living, and lead very good lives. But they're not the, you know, the upper crust. They're not the CEOs. They're not the Wall Street traders. They're solid middle class folks.
They're the backbone of the country, and that's what's under attack right now. You know, the bureaucrats, even on a national level, they're trying to eliminate the middle class. Right? They want to, you know, oppress people. They want to be able to control things. Everything's about money. It's really quite sickening when you look at it. You know, and it's funny, too, because what happens is, you know, both my parents, I got into the union a lot because both my parents were leaders in their unions. My mother was a union president for over 25 years. My father was a vice president in his union for many, many years. And they would always say that it's the people that didn't understand education that unfortunately got to be in charge of education. So you'd have these people that were failed teachers, more or less, that would become these administrators and be controlling what goes on, even though they weren't in the trenches. That's what I see with Corbett. And these people that are making decisions on the education, I mean, they don't know anything about what it's like to be here in the trenches, to educate these students, to get them to move forward. I mean, basically, they've messed up things as it is, right? So, you know, Corbett, he was a teacher for 1 year, and yet he's talked about how he knows education because he's been in the classroom. I mean, you know, give me a break. He has no idea what it's like to be in the classroom.
I walked through an operating room once. Does that make me a surgeon?
Yeah, right. Well, it's like the Holiday Inn commercials that they have on there, right? Where the guy thinks he's smart because he stayed at the Express, but really he has nothing to, you know, he doesn't know anything about the subject at hand. Yeah, I mean, you know, Corbett doesn't know anything about the classroom. If he did, he wouldn't be doing things of this nature. And watching those hearings yesterday, too, You know, I sat in, I was actually in the hearing when they were talking about PASCHE. And the questions that the legislators were asking, they were good questions, right? But they had nothing to do with the education of the students or the budget. You know, one of the questions was about the alcohol problem that exists on campus. And yeah, I mean, that's a problem, right? But it's not
Is
just
it?
The PASCHE system. I mean, that's a problem everywhere. In the meantime, what's it got to do with cutting the budget? In fact, I would say cutting the budget would basically make that problem worse, no? Because you don't have the resources to deal with things like that on campus, you know? And another legislator asked about diversity on campus. And again, you should have a diverse faculty. It's better for the students. There's better experience. But again, nothing to do with the budget. What is cutting the budget, right? I mean, how's that going to help the diversity on campus, right?
Well, maybe there's somewhere here. Maybe by having a more diverse faculty, we could get, you know, professors from Guatemala and Mexico and China and all these places around the world where we don't even have to pay them a couple of pennies.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, maybe that's what they're thinking.
Might bring the budget. I can't think of their other rationales, because when I look at this, it's infuriating. And as I said, you know, I've got a 2-4 and 8-year-old. Their futures depend on what happens here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have 2 children myself, you know. I have cousins that are young that are still going to have to be educated in the college system. You know, the thing that bothers me is also, you know, what I see is a setup, and that they're going to try to blame this on the faculty and the unions that are involved with the colleges. I mean, you could see that one legislator asked the question, oh, well, what are the faculty's salaries? We want to see a list of them. First of all, it shows you how uninformed they are, right? Because the faculty salaries are online. You
yep.
can look them up. It's public information, yep. right? But then to make a comment that, you know, the faculty all get paid 6 figures, well, that's not true. I don't get paid 6 figures at all, right? I'm not anywhere near that. So I think that, you know, a lot of the people in the legislature, they just don't have an understanding for what goes on in education. And maybe it's on purpose. You know, I tend to try to not be a pessimist, but you're right. You know, if you keep the people uneducated, they're easier to control, and unfortunately, it seems to be headed in that direction.
And that's what worries me.
Yeah, no, it's a big worry. I mean, you look at the details, and this is what I try to hammer home to the faculty when I get the chance to speak, and to the students I talk to. You know, it's one thing to talk about the middle class and stuff like that, but actually look at the details of Corbett's budget and where he's dumping the money. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You know, and he can't, I assume he's an educated man. He can't be that misguided, right? So what's going on that you would dump money and increase your prison system? You know, and the details, too, you look at it, right? There are 32 prison systems, I believe, in the state. I think 23 of them never met the budget that they had last year, but yet you increase their budget this year, right? I mean, does that make any sense?
Well,
you know, when you do a budget, you basically look at what you spent last year, and you base it off of that. And, you know, even though we're not through the year, you can do a small calculation, a 9-12 calculation, to see that you're not going to spend what you budgeted this year. It just doesn't make the priorities that he's put in this budget. It's either just really, he just really doesn't know what he's doing, or there's something behind it. And, again, maybe it is to control people. It's just sad that it's come to that, you know.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And to be honest, by increasing the prison budget, maybe that's where some of those kids who are not going to be able to afford to go to college next year are going to end up.
And that's the thing, you know, are you going to pay to incarcerate people, or are you going to pay to educate them, right? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And you look at some of the areas that they're spending money, and I know there's rules between capital projects and what you would call a general budget. You know, all that stuff's very complicated, but still, is there a way around the rule where you have to spend money to paint your prison that year? I mean, you have a budget deficit. You're looking at people losing jobs. Do you need to paint the prison? I think the prisoners will live without their walls painted 1 year, you know. You know, you got a hole in the roof, that's one thing, but painting? Yeah, well, I just, the priorities and stuff that's being done, it's disgusting to me.
All right, priorities, absolutely. So where are we going from here? When's the next big rally? What's the plan?
We're trying to get another rally on campus next Tuesday. That's what's in the works right now. And again, we're trying to let the students drive this because, again, we want to make sure it's coming from them and it's not perceived. You know, if it's perceived as coming from the faculty, that could harm the cause. You know, not that the faculty don't have a right to be angry, but, you know, the students got to be most important here. And, you know, what we're going to try to do is then get another rally to Harrisburg. I mean, that's the way this is going to happen. You know, I stood there on the steps and you're looking and you see all these students, about 1,000 students, whatever, lined up on the steps. And it was great. It was wonderful. But then I'm looking back, and I see this whole street that goes all the way back to the river, right? Got to fill it. Got to fill that with students and just quadruple the number. And so that's going to be our goal, at least here at Kutztown, and working with the other schools. We want to basically go back to Harrisburg, fill that place up, and make them hear these kids, because this is the only way it's going to change. Man, you know, we can put enough pressure on him, and it won't be the evil faculty, right? It'll be the students that are actually affected. You know, when the governor chooses to, you know, dump money into oil drilling instead of into education.
I'm right there with you. Whatever we can do to help, we will be right there with you, whatever you need.
I appreciate that. You're a big, it was great to have you there today, too. And I'm very thankful that you're able to make the trip down.
I appreciate your time, Professor Quinn. Thanks so much.
Okay, you take care.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Is this the right move? Do we steal the future away, or do we invest? Back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Executive Director of CAIU on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-962-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just applied for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you're rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, the 2012 election seems to be heating up. At least all of the wannabes seem to be lining up to, hey, look at me, hey, look at me. What I find interesting is one of Mitt Romney's, one of Romney's closest advisors, an MIT professor named Jonathan Gruber, he was an advisor to Romney and Obama on their health care plans, told the Washington Post today that without Romney's plan, and more specifically, that plan that has an individual mandate, President Obama could have never gotten his plan through Congress. And you look at this and you go, was that just the stab in the heart to the Romney campaign? Did they just stab Romney in the heart by saying, by this guy, one of his advisors, saying it was huge to get this through? It's like Obamacare would have not become law. I think that's a stab in the heart. I think conservatives are going to lose their ever-loving freaking mind.
I'm not so sure that's an accurate statement, but let's be honest. He isn't going to get the nomination because of the fact that Republicans will never forgive him for offering health care for all in Massachusetts.
Currently, 98% of the residents of Massachusetts and 99.8% of the children are covered by health insurance. As Gruber notes, it's both sad and depressing that Romney has to run away from his accomplishments in order to satisfy conservative primary voters. The reality is it works. It may not be perfect, but it's working. 98% of the people in that state, 99.8% of the kids, covered by health insurance. I mean, I would be running with that all day long. That would be my mantra.
Maybe 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, you might be able to get away with it, but in this Republican Party, there is no way. Not when Michelle Bachmann is considered a somewhat mainstream. How far has that Republican Party gone to the right? Of course, she's in the wackadoodle end of it. I mean, she's really in the crazy end of it, but... Wow, to be even serious, the things that woman has said, and Palin for that matter, and to be seriously considered for the President of the United States is not only scary, it makes no sense at all.
Well, I love Michelle Bachmann.
I know, you like her because she's attractive.
She's nuts.
And
she's out of her,
the problem,
she's
it,
out of her skull.
You seem to have flashbacks to when you were real young.
Yes, well.
You like crazy women. Hey, nothing wrong with that, you know, to each his own. But, you know, it's one thing to be a crazy girlfriend, Rick. It's quite another to run this country.
Yeah, good point. Good point indeed. Speaking of another presidential candidate, Tim Pawlenty is in the news saying, maybe, this is his quote. Here's his quote. As to repatriating foreign income, of course, Larry, talking to Larry Kudlow on CNBC, we're getting none of that now, and offering a dramatic reduction or even a holiday for repatriation makes perfect sense. So what we're talking about, and if you don't get the repatriation thing, they want GE, who only claimed to have $5 of its $14 billion, was created here in the U.S. They want to bring the rest of that money back, the rest of that other $9 billion back, and not have to pay any tax on it. So that they can then control more of the market, buy up more, and divvy out more to the very, very wealthy. Along with David Camp's idea, the Michigan Republican who wants to lower the top marginal tax rate down to 25% and the corporate income tax down to 25%, so we can give away a whole bunch more, creating even larger deficits. I mean, that's the part with all this, Jake. When you start talking about cutting these taxes and handing more money to corporations and handing more money to the very wealthy, what does that mean? Well, it means less revenue, higher deficits. It means we're going to have to get to keep programs going from somewhere, or we slash those programs out and people suffer. That seems to be the end of this.
Well, I mean, you stumbled onto something here, Rick, and it happened during the Reagan administration. I believe some of these things they do to make the economy worse, and when that happens, you got to pull in your economic strings a little bit, cut back in spending, and at that point, they can starve some of the programs which they absolutely abhor. I mean, seriously, I mean, look at the programs they don't like. Social Security, Medicare, unemployment, workman's comp, they're going after all of it. Worker safety, they're going after that. Those are the things that they abhor. They want to go back to the, quote, good old days, unquote. Well, you didn't have that, you know, these regulations that, you know, it's just a pain in the butt, you know. It's just, we shouldn't have to put up with that, according to them. And they sincerely believe that that's the way we should run the country. And that, indeed, is a sobering thought.
Well, here's the thing. Plenty's also in the news. Yesterday he was on Laura Ingraham's show, and he was talking about climate change, and he said that everybody in the race, well, at least the big names in the race, embraced climate change or cap and trade at one point or another, every one of us. And the truth of the matter is, you're right. Pawlenty, Romney, Gingrich, Hubby, Daniels, Palin, all of them, at one point or another, they embraced climate change. Then they figured out, in order to get elected, they had to pander to the big polluters, to the Koch brothers, and to the big moneyed interests who don't want that. And then they realized really quickly it was hard right. You'd better make that turn or you're not going to be elected. So that's the reason they flipped on that. And you got to say, look, and I'm not going to give them a pass, but the reality is in order to get elected in the Republican Party, you have got to walk a certain line. And that line is to deny climate change. Simple, pure and simple. And our other presidential candidate, right here in the great home state of Pennsylvania.
I was just going to bring that up.
Tricky Ricky Santorum, he said today that America has an abortion culture, and it's harming Social Security. So in order for us to revive the Social Security system, in his opinion, he said the system, in his opinion, is a flawed design, period. But having said that, the design would work a lot better if we had a stable demographic trends. He goes on to explain that we don't have enough workers to support retirees because a third of all young people in America are not in America today because of abortion. So let me ask you this, Tricky Ricky. If we did have all those, all that demographic that you're talking about, where would they work? We've got 14.5 million people who are unemployed right now, can't find jobs. Where would all of these jobs mysteriously come from? He goes on to say we have 7 children, so we're doing our part to fund Social Security. How are you doing that? Can you explain how you having seven children has anything to do with Social Security?
He's talking about the future. You know, there's one question I like to ask this guy, and even for Santorum. I mean, even for Santorum, this is crazy. If you remember, Rick, in 2006, what was the big issue for him? If you remember.
Well, it was defense. No, he was the terrorist.
He wanted
guy.
To private. Well, that, but beyond that, his big thing, if you remember, went all over the state to do what? Wanted to privatize Social Security. Never once mentioned the abortion in this context. Now, all of a sudden, because he's running for president and he wants to stick out among a group of crazies, he's bringing this up. I mean, this kind of thing is, wow. And I went online, Rick, and I looked at the comments, and there were a bunch of Republicans that said, wow, I can't vote for this man, and I'm a Republican.
He's nuts.
I can't vote for him.
Well, if you remember Tom DeLay, this is what Tom DeLay said before we take a break. Here's DeLay's clip. Same thing.
Had those 40 million children that were killed over the last 30 years, we wouldn't need the illegal immigrants to fill the jobs that they are doing today.
No, it's the same logic, the exact same logic, because we have all those cheap laborers. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Will O'Neill from Walmart Watch. A big case was heard today. We're right back after this.
Let us get sick. Don't let us get old. Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shinsburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. March 25th saw the 100th anniversary of the tragic Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. On that date in 1911, the factory, located in New York City, resulted in the deaths of 146 garment workers. The employees had been locked inside the building by management, so they couldn't leave before the end of their shifts. As a result, when the fire started, few could escape, and many jumped to their deaths. On Friday in New York City, a memorial service was held which saw thousands of New Yorkers gather to pay their respects. Workers United President Bruce Rayner was one of those that spoke at the memorial. He wore a pin on his jacket that called for solidarity with Wisconsin workers, who are watching as Republican Governor Scott Walker strips their collective bargaining rights.
If you look up at those windows and see the purple banners, those were the windows out of which dozens of young women garment workers ages 14 to 25 were forced to jump out of those windows and be crushed to death on the sidewalk. We honor their memory, as we have been doing for generations at this spot every year.
Some of those that died in the fire were as young as 14. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire resulted in a new fight for workplace safety laws and child labor laws. New York Senator Chuck Schumer spoke about the new era that arose after the fire.
The phoenix that rose out of the ashes of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire was a clarion call to action. It supercharged the American labor movement and emboldened activists and lawmakers alike to push forward with landmark workplace safety laws, child labor laws, and most of all, collective bargaining rights.
Throughout the country, during the last half of March, events have been held commemorating the tragic fire. In Washington, D.C., on March 21st, a symposium was held to talk about the fire and its aftermath. Panelist and author Kristen Downey explained how people found their voices after the fire, but how we've seemed to have lost our voices in this new century.
You only need 50 people working together to make anything happen. 50 people harnessed together. I mean, how many do we have in this room right now? Like, we've got like 80 here at least. You know, surely within us there are 50 people who can make some things happen. I think that's what Sis Perkins would say.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Well, today, back in 1918, is a monumentous day. Sam Walton, the founder of the huge and bitterly anti-worker, anti-union Walmart empire, was born in Kingfisher, Oklahoma. I remember the days when Sam used to say, "We want Walmart to have Buy American." I remember Buy American all over the place. And now, and this is no great testament to him, don't get me wrong, now Walmart is the largest importer of foreign-made goods. In fact, they're often the driving force for American business to be forced to China, to be forced out of this country, because they want to be able to push down the price so they can profit, pure and simple. Anyway, today a big Supreme Court case was heard. The discrimination case is a class action suit. A bunch of women who have been passed over, underpaid, mistreated, you know, a whole litany of things. This case went before the Supreme Court. That's why I've asked Will O'Neill from Walmart Watch to come talk to us about that. What it was like today, what the possible outcome could be. Will, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, thank you so much for having me on.
So lay it out for me. What happened today?
Well, today, before the Supreme Court, they heard oral arguments concerning whether these 1 million-plus women could be considered a class. So the Supreme Court wasn't really talking about the facts of the case, whether discrimination occurred. What they were talking about was whether the six named plaintiffs in the Dukes versus Walmart case can constitute a class of, if that could be expanded to a class of more than 1 million women. So that was the question before the court today.
And why is that important?
Well, the reason that is important is because Walmart's known for not having very high wages. And even with the discrimination that's gone on over time, a lot of these women wouldn't be making a particularly a great amount more money had the discrimination not occurred. So many of these women would not have the opportunity to bring a suit against Walmart individually because the money that they're talking about wouldn't be all that much. So in order for there to be justice for all the women that worked at Walmart, they really do need to be constituted as a class.
So basically, you know, and this is the way I took this when of my reading of it, is Walmart's not at all at this point defending whether there was discrimination or not. Clearly, you listen to these stories, I don't know how you could come to any other conclusion, but it's simply on a procedural thing saying, we don't think that all of these people should be able to come together. They should have to sue us individually.
Walmart knew that there was discrimination going on. You know, prior to the Duke's case being brought, their own lawyers had told them that this was a large problem within their organization. But you're absolutely right. Today's Supreme Court case was about the procedural question of whether this could be taken as a class.
And the idea, I guess, you know, in looking at it from their perspective, is we can slow this down for generations. We can tie this up in litigation. After all, they are the largest employer in the country. They are a very powerful, very wealthy corporation who could quite simply outlast any human being.
Oh, any individual that was to bring a suit against it, against Walmart, really would have a very hard time, you know, going through the entire process. Walmart could definitely outlast anyone in the courtroom. And, you know, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to, you know, fight fines that were only tens of thousands of dollars. So they've got the staying power to go up against anyone in litigation. What Walmart would like to do is to have each of these cases be ruled individually, which would simply deny justice to too many women. Basically, what Walmart is saying is that this class of women is too big. And Walmart is basically saying that Walmart itself is too big for justice.
The big, too big to fail thing. That's beautiful. You know, as I look at this and I look at these cases and I look at the attacks across the country on collective bargaining rights, I look at Walmart as, you know, why aren't workers clamoring to labor organizations saying, represent us, please, because All these women are being discriminated against. There are some of the folks that I've talked to, horrible stories about how they're punched out and not you know, collecting their paychecks and a whole bunch of stuff.
I hear from Walmart associates every day, and you know, I've got some very close relationships with a number of current and former Walmart associates, and I do hear stories about a lot of problems with discrimination. Favoritism is a big complaint that I hear from associates on a pretty regular basis. And there are certainly associates who are coming together in small ways to stand together. But Walmart has continually been one of the, I would say that they're a leader in the anti-union world. You know, they were one of the first companies to really have a labor team come on. They have teams of lawyers that go out to all their stores and hold captive audience meetings on a pretty regular basis at the first sniff of anyone trying to organize and stand together. And they've done a very effective job over the years of shutting down organizing drives. You know, I'd point you to the store in Jonquière, Canada, where they actually closed the store
right
as a result of people going through the card check process. And I would also point you to, you know, a case in Texas, you know, 8 years ago now, where they closed an entire department across the state of Texas. They closed the meat cutting department across the state of Texas because those units had organized. So, you know, people are very afraid of their job. They're, you know, afraid for their job. They're afraid to speak out. You know, in these captive audience meetings, they, you know, tell them terrible things. They, you know, intimate that they could lose their position, that the union wouldn't be able to help them in any way. So we do hear from them, but we know that a lot of Walmart associates are scared.
Well, again, this is where I think labor law reform is so desperately needed, and you know, basically just the fact that people come together and support each other, which is why I think we're seeing these attacks on collective bargaining. Let's move back to the case. What were, can you lay some of the arguments for moving forward with the class action suit out?
Well, like we said earlier, this is pretty much a procedural question. So, you know, basically, with the procedural question, it's been upheld by the Court of Appeals that, you know, this could move forward. It,
asking, is there enough evidence for there to be a class action suit in this case? And I think that moving forward, if the Supreme Court was to uphold the ruling, we would see one of the largest, successful class action suit in this case, because there is such a pattern of discrimination. There is such a culture within Walmart that led to discrimination against women. So I think that you would see a big move toward worker empowerment, and I would also believe that you would see a lot more companies take discrimination seriously and be working with their employees to try and prevent something like this from happening.
Sadly, I got to be honest, I don't know that our conservative Supreme Court is going to go the way that I hope they go, simply for what you just laid out. The fact that this is going to cost a lot of corporations a lot of money, and it will, on some level things out. I don't know that corporate America wants that to happen, and I think our corporate-controlled justices may not do what we hope.
We had actually called, in the run-up to this, we had actually called on Justice Scalia to recuse himself, speaking of a conservative Supreme Court, due to the fact that his son actually works for the law firm that is representing Walmart in the case, and his son, Eugene Scalia, has on numerous occasions represented Walmart, especially in some wage and hour stuff, and is intimately familiar with this case. Scalia did not refuse himself, obviously. He was involved in the argument today. I think that I would like to think that this Supreme Court will follow the rule of law in this case. This is really not a question of the facts of this case. This is a procedural question that clearly the bar's been met for this to be a class.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I actually thought that Citizens United would go the other way because you had 100 years of law on your side that they just turned their backs on and flipped over.
I certainly appreciate that this court has ruled in some ways that I personally have not liked, but we are hopeful that in this case, they will follow the rule of law.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Will O'Neill, I appreciate your time, brother. Thanks for the update. Thanks for what's, filling us in, giving us a little information. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Rick, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yep. Will O'Neill, Walmart Watch. There's a link to our website at therickSmithShow.com. Take you over to their website to get some more information on this case and on where we're going forward. I got to be honest. I'm hoping... I'm hoping that it goes the right way. There's the part of me that just not buying it. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Corporate chieftains who have relentlessly pushed American factories and our middle-class jobs offshore rationalize this globalization of production by declaring that it's all about efficiency, as though that's the highest value to which a civilization can aspire. Values aside, however, the problem with corporate efficiencies is that too often they are not. Not efficient, that is. This is because the corporate scheme of moving stuff from A to B to G to Y in order to achieve the narrow goal of maximizing profits can look so simple, sensible, and even slick in a boardroom PowerPoint presentation, largely because it ignores inconvenient realities, such as earthquakes, tsunamis, and nuclear meltdowns. For example, Shreveport, Louisiana, has been jolted by the horrific 1-2-3 blow that has pummeled Japan. What hit Shreveport was not a seismic aftershock, but the inherent fragility of the distant supplier networks built by profiteering globalizers. A GM truck plant in this city has had to shut down because one truck part made factory in the devastated area of Japan is not presently available. One. Amazing. Cars and trucks have about 20,000 parts, but the inability to get even a single one delivered from abroad can bring an entire assembly line to a halt. GM's bean counters had decided at some point that they could have this gizmo made in and shipped from Japan a bit cheaper than making it here. So GM and other globalizers have made themselves and us dependent on an unreliable, far-flung network of foreign factories. Moreover, these scattered suppliers also are at the mercy of their suppliers. A plastic gadget maker in Japan, for example, might rely on a Chinese plant for the chemical to make the plastic. This is Jim Hightower saying, the efficiency of globalization is nothing but a cross-your-fingers fantasy.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the high or lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the... And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com and how to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. I've got Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service. Jeff, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, no problem, Rick. Good to be on.
Lots of reaction from the president's speech last night.
Yeah, well, you know, the president obviously went into the speech last night having to make the case not only to the public but to members of Congress that us being in Libya, but he also had to make the case that, you know, we're not going to be there, you know, for an unlimited amount of time, and that it's in our national interest. And I think that he's getting mixed reviews. He got mixed reviews today, I should say. You know, some critics who were opposed to us being there continued their assault on the president and said he should have, you know, gone in a couple weeks ago and he should have consulted Congress. Others said, you know, they liked the speech. They liked the fact that the president shed some clarity on the mission, and they liked the fact that he pledged that this would not be an open-ended commitment to Libya. This would be more of a defined mission in which we would, you know, help set up the no-fly zone and then sort of hand off to our international partners. And, you know, so the president from here, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not, you know, how long we'll be there. But one thing is for sure, and that is that the president has clearly laid out a, you know, a strategy, and that is that, you know, we're in sort of a transition period where we're handing off the lead role to our international partners. We're going to be in sort of a support role from here on out. And the president also pledged that we will not send ground troops in, and I think that that was sort of a much-needed thing for a lot of people to hear.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I listened to the speech, and I wish it would have been, like you said, 2 weeks ago. I thought it was, he said some good things, but at the end of it, I'm still not in favor of the way he went about it.
And I think that that's, you know, a criticism that not only Republicans but Democrats are sharing in is the fact that, you know, a couple weeks ago you had rebel forces in Libya making significant strides against the regime forces of Muammar Gaddafi, and then that seemed to stall, and it seemed to reverse, to be quite honest. And when by the time that the U.S. went in, along with France and Britain and others in the international community, we were going in to try and help the rebels regain their footing. And now it looks as though, you know, the rebels have made some strides, but, you know, there were reports today that a Western initiative by the rebels was, you know, more or less quelled by the Gaddafi regime. And a lot of people are predicting this could end up in sort of a stalemate. So, if indeed it does become a stalemate, then the question is how long, do we, you know, impose the keep the no-fly zone, I should say, and put pressure on Gaddafi? Because, you know, the president stated last night in his speech that the ultimate objective here is for the rebel forces to pressure Gaddafi, so much that he has to leave. And it's not so much an effort where the U.S. sends, you know, troops in to try and get Gaddafi to leave, but, you know, counter to that. So I think that that's the main question that a lot of people have on their mind.
And we will see how that works its way out. Now the budget, this is something that, I got to be honest, I'm not seeing good things. What's going on there?
Well, you know, I think right now it's likely that we probably won't get a deal done this week. And, of course, the current continuing resolution that's keeping the government funded expires on April 8th, which is next Friday. It's not a lot of time. And if you ask Steny Hoyer, he's the number two Democrat in the House, he said today that he thinks there's a 60% chance that there could be a government shutdown. And, of course, that would happen if a budget deal is not agreed to by House and Senate leaders. Now, I know that Democrats in the White House have proposed an additional $20 billion of the spending cuts to Republicans. That offer has more or less been rejected by Republicans. And Democrats today went on the offense saying that Tea Party Republicans, the conservative faction of the party, is to blame for bringing House leaders away from those discussions. So it looks like we're back to the drawing board. I think the likely result is that with another CR, another continuing resolution that will fund the government for a couple more weeks to buy leaders more time to negotiate on a long-term budget.
Well, maybe they shouldn't have taken a vacation last week.
Well, you know, Congress, for all its complaining and griping about Obama not consulting with them on Libya, you know, they gave themselves the option of taking last week off to go home and talk to their constituents. And, you know, they could have called themselves into an emergency session, not only to consult about Libya, but to get to work on this budget deal. And the problem with this budget is that, you know, the more uncertainty you create, the more it affects the job market. And not only, you know, in the private sector, but, of course, in the federal sector, too, where agencies just have no idea if they're going to be able to add payroll or have to shrink, you know, this time next year. And so a lot of people are looking at Congress and saying, why didn't you guys take last week, take the opportunity to call yourselves back into session? It's been done before. There's certainly precedent, but Congress decided that it wasn't worth it.
Well, again, I lay this at the doorstep of the Republicans, the party of no, the ones who love to see the chaos, who don't believe in government, yet for some odd reason we keep putting them back into the halls of Congress to continue to destroy our government. Tomorrow, I guess the president's giving a big speech on energy.
That's right, Rick. The president will be at Georgetown University, and he'll sort of expand on his energy strategy that he touched upon in his State of the Union. You know, the president talked a lot in his State of the Union about a clean energy standard, something that he wants Congress to work on. He's going to push for that tomorrow big time. And at the same time, you have Republicans in the House crafting energy legislation that seems to fly right in the face of what the president is proposing. Republicans today announced that they are pushing legislation that will increase oil drilling, offshore oil exploration and oil drilling as a means of boosting domestic energy production. The Obama administration, meanwhile, is completely at odds with that for the most part. They've, you know, pushed hard for more investment in clean energy and obviously, you know, they're looking at wind and solar and all those sources of alternative energy as things that we should be spending on and investing on as a means of getting off oil, and especially foreign oil. And you've seen, you know, with the unrest in Libya and other areas in the Middle East, there's definitely a need to move away from that because it can be, undependable, I should say, at times. So you're going to see the president talk a lot about a clean energy standard tomorrow and sort of lay out his big push for energy reform.
Well, leave it to the pushers to keep pushing the same drug on us. Keep the needle in our arm. Amazing stuff. Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service. Appreciate your time, brother.
Thanks, Rick. Take care.
All righty. And now to find out what's going on here in Harrisburg, what do you got for us?
An AP study, AP story, Rick. Pennsylvania expected to receive about $64 million this fiscal year in royalties from natural gas drilling on state-owned land. Governor Tom Corbett said today that figure is expected to rise to $300 million by the year 2015-16 just on the leases the state currently holds. Corbett made the case for the state budget proposal to the Lebanon Valley Chamber of Commerce today at its spring luncheon in Marystown, Lebanon County. Corbett spent about a third of 45-minute speech defending his position not to tax Marcellus Shale drilling to plug the state's $4 billion deficit. Said the natural gas industry already paid $71 million in state sales and use tax over the last 2 years. Who says they don't pay taxes, Corbett asked. Proponents of natural gas extraction say the revenue would go to municipalities affected by drilling and could dilute some of Corbett's proposed cuts, including his 50% cut to higher education. They say he won't consider a tax because he received about $1 million from the oil and gas companies during his campaign. But Corbett criticized use an extraction tax to balance a budget rather than as a result of good planning or good strategy. And he said that the tax the former governor Ed Rendell pushed last year would only have generated $200 million, not nearly enough to cover the deficit. I want to nurture the industry, Corbett said. Everyone says, oh, I do it because the industry contributed funds to my campaign, which they did, absolutely. You have to ask them why. But I think it's because I have a vision of where we're going to take this industry. Corbett said Lebanon County business and residents could help further the industry by creating new markets to sell natural glass so the demand goes up, such as getting convenience stores to install natural gas pumps or township fleets to convert to natural gas-powered vehicles. Some interesting observations from the governor.
Yeah, it's the invisible hand. The invisible hand will take care of it. Don't worry about it. And, you know, this whole idea that, well, there's some tax being paid. Oh, yeah, there's some tax coming in. Just isn't cutting it for me. Look, at the end of the day, if you want to be like Texas, let's be like Texas. Texas has a 7.5% extraction tax. You put that needle in the ground, you pay 7.5% on everything that comes out. We're already, and this is what gets me, we're already paying this. It's already in their business plan. That just means they've got a 7.5% little bonus in their pocket at the end of the year that used to come to us, that now is no longer coming to us. You know, I look at Alaska. You know, I have a relative who lives in Alaska, and he tells me about the good socialist state there of Alaska and how every year he goes out to his mailbox and look, Lordy Lord, there is a check in the box. There's money that comes back from the drillers. And that's his money because they believe that's their resource. So I find it quite interesting that here in the state of Pennsylvania, we don't think that that's our resource, that that's the state's resource. And I go back to this, you better learn from history. You better learn from the fact that this used to be called Penn's Woods. And they came in and they stripped out a bunch of trees. And we used to have oil. If you remember Titusville, Pennsylvania, where they found oil. And all the problems that came along with that. If you know the coal regions just north of here. And all of the strip mining and all of the destruction and devastation and all of the environmental mess that came along with all of that, you would think, you know, one would just maybe think that, oh, I don't know, you know, we just might want to think about being proactive. I know it's not the American way. I think Winston Churchill once said, Americans always do the right thing after doing everything else first. So I guess this is just that progression of doing everything else first before getting around to doing the right thing. But what's it going to cost us in the long run, Jake? How long down the road are we going to go before we realize that, again, we're making the wrong choices?
Well, the only reason he's able to get away with that politically is because his party has firm grip on the legislature and the governor's office. If the Democrats were in control, they would be taxing, and rightfully so.
I want to be like Texas, but we're not going to tax them.
Well, he claims if we don't tax them, maybe, just maybe, they'll move their corporate headquarters here, although what does that entail? What does that mean? What are they? First of all, I don't think it's realistic, but even if it was realistic, what does that mean? Are we supposed to give away everything free, open the gates for them? You know, on a certain level, he makes a case. I don't agree with it, but he does make a case. But he doesn't articulate. He doesn't go further. No. What exactly would that mean?
During the break, I got an email from a professor in one of the 14 state universities. She says, as I listen to your show, I'm finding many, many things I agree with. One of the legislators' questions yesterday that really, really burned me was to request a full list of professors' salaries, which, of course, as Professor Quinn said, everything, it's all online. It's all in the collective bargaining agreement. It's all public knowledge. She goes on to say, what about the salaries of many redundant or unnecessary administrators, which I've been talking about for the longest time. But here's where the observation to the Marcellus Shale is important. She said, personally, I think Corbett realizes that he needs a large, uneducated workforce for the burgeoning Marcellus Shale industry. That's the reason for financially starving the Pennsylvania higher education people. And, you know, I think there's some some very sadistic thought there. And I do think that. I think they're taking money away from higher education, maybe to put it into the technical schools to be able to take care of the drillers to make sure that they're well taken care of. Anyway, I appreciate the email. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
That was today back in 1852. that Ohio made it illegal for children under 18 and women to work more than 10 hours a day. And I got to look at this, the fact that you've seen union rights being stripped away, collective bargaining rights taken away from workers in Ohio. And it just kind of goes, you know, really? Are we going back? Are we going that far back? It's just amazing stuff. So what else you got, Jake?
Well, you mentioned something about what happened in Michigan with the unemployment, Rick. The rest of the story is this. Yes, the governor proposed cutting unemployment from 30 weeks to 20 weeks. And according to the article in one of the newspapers up there, this was his explanation, the governor's explanation. His circuitous reasoning went like this. By slashing the number of weeks jobless workers can get state aid, workers presently receiving extended federal benefits can continue to collect those benefits. However, the real explanation is this. So far in 2011, 11 states have made the same technical changes required to continue extended benefits without making other changes that will hurt workers. There is no valid reason why keeping federally financed extended benefits in place in Michigan should require a permanent reduction in 26 weeks of unemployment benefits. So basically the governor is hiding by the fact that he has a large number of unemployed, and he's saying because of that he has to reduce benefits from 26 to 20 weeks, which is nonsense. It's just another way of cutting back on programs that they don't like. $4 billion in hand, NFL owners stick it to the workers. An article coming out from the AFL-CIO blog. According to some inside sources, the Buffalo Bills have already announced pay cuts across the organization, calling it a program of sheriff's sacrifice. But the concession workers and game day workers are doing all the sharing. Workers like Billy Feliciano, mother two, works at the 49er stadium in San Francisco, and who says a lockout would mean she and her coworkers would not have any money to take care of her families. In the middle of a massive and prolonged national economic downturn, the NFL is also placing its rank and file employees, the ones who work in ticket sales and promotions and community relations, who aren't in the front of the camera on third and one and won't earn in 10 years what Tom Brady earns in 10 minutes, are in serious financial distress. At the end of the day, the union is claiming that these cities will lose about 150,000 jobs if you talk about those who work at the stadiums, the concessionaires, and also those who work behind the scenes for the NFL. So there's a lot at stake here. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. The owners now have about a $4 billion fund that they got from the major networks, and that could get awfully ugly. I think both sides don't want to give in. And it could prove awful ugly. I know I'm going to miss football if it doesn't occur next fall. We talk about what's happening in Libya, Rick. According to Reuters, an article came out today, the United States has spent about $550 million so far in military operations in Libya, but they expect costs to stabilize at about $40 million per month once U.S. forces are reduced and NATO takes over greater control. According to the Pentagon on Tuesday, the Defense Department said about 60% of the added costs were for missiles and bombs with the rest for transporting troops to the region and combat operations. NATO's top operations commander told U.S. senators that the U.S. military operations in Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi is battling rebel forces seeking to oust the Libyan leader, had cost hundreds of millions of dollars so far. Again, even though this administration says they did it for humanitarian reasons, when you look at the numbers, that's still a lot of money that we don't have at a time when we're in economic problems and there's a lot of suffering people. I'm not so sure we can keep doing this, even though I think the majority of the American people are on the side of the Obama administration, but it becomes harder and harder, Rick, to justify in this country doing these kind of things from a humanitarian standpoint. This is a subject that from time to time we have talked about. I know it's not a labor issue, but there's an article in another Reuters article, a gentleman who had been in jail for years and years and years for a crime he didn't commit, a man by the name of Joseph White, Rick. Apparently he tragically died this week in an accident. He had been in jail for a long time. He was sentenced in a murder trial going back about 15 years. No, in fact, it's 20. In 1989, White and five others were charged in his sexual assault and death of a 68-year-old Helen Wilson of Beatrice, Nebraska. White was the only one to maintain his innocence and insisted on a trial. He was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. And this is the key, and this is why I pretty much oppose death penalties. The others, and the names I'm not going to bother, pleaded guilty or no contest to reduce charges. Some of their testimony against him swayed a jury in White's case. They found him innocent. He was awarded, DNA evidence then at a later point proved him to be innocent. They released him. He received about $25,000 from the state of Nebraska in compensation last year for being wrongly imprisoned in the 1985 killing. Legislation to pay him the remaining $475,000 was pending Tuesday in the Nebraska legislature as part of the annual state claims bill. Also pending is a federal lawsuit against Gate County officials. Now, it's going to be interesting to see if his family inherits that money. Here we have a situation where prosecutors plea bargained with these other individuals that were supposedly involved in the murder, got them to testify against a man who was wrongfully accused of murder. They got lesser sentences. He wound up spending all that time in prison. That's one of the reasons I really have a problem with the death penalty. If it wasn't for DNA, he'd still be on death row. One other news report from Reuters. Reuters has some good stuff today. The first of five U.S. soldiers charged with killing unarmed Afghan civilians last year was sentenced Wednesday, 24 years in prison after pleading guilty to three counts of premeditated murder. The judge presiding over the case, Lieutenant Colonel Kwasi Hanks, accepted Murtox, who's the individual that was accused. He plea deal with prosecutors at the end of a prolonged proceeding at Joint Base Lewis-McChord near Tacoma and handed Murtox a 24-year prison term. They were accused of killing several Afghanis and then, unfortunately, in a gruesome tale, took pictures. Those pictures were found. He was reported, prosecuted, and unfortunately, this young man, he's in his early 20s, is going to serve a good bit of his life behind bars. Sad tale. Sad tale, Rick. That's what I got.
That's it?
That's it.
So our Borowitz report for the day, Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi took the extraordinary steps of banning all journalists, writes Andy Borowitz from his country today, arguing it's worked for Fox. According to advisors to the Libyan dictator, Mr. Gaddafi has been studying the Fox News channel closely in recent weeks as an example of a large enterprise that has thrilled in the absence of journalism. One aide to the Libyan dictator said Colonel Gaddafi has made no secret of his admiration for Fox. He has even told his nurses to wear more makeup so they will look like Fox anchor women. Speaking to the Libyan state television this morning, Mr. Gaddafi said that by expelling all journalists from Libya, he was protecting the Libyan people from the bias and distortions of the lamestream media. The Libyan dictator said he was establishing a no-spin zone over the country, replacing all actual news with a series of television shows allowing for a free exchange of opinions, all of them his. Mr. Gaddafi's actions drew immediate criticism. Fox owner Rupert Murdoch, who said, quote, "a brutal dictator who is hostile to journalism." It definitely sounds like he is ripping me off. At the State Department, an official spokesperson offered his response to Gaddafi's actions, saying, as a State Department policy, we will wait several weeks and then issue a confusing non-committal statement. Meanwhile, seven prominent Republicans voiced criticism of President Obama's Libya policy, including George W. Bush, who urged Mr. Obama to define his mission That way, you can hang up a real cool banner once it's accomplished. Michelle Bachmann, Republican from Minnesota, said she also had serious questions for Mr. Obama about Libya. For example, where is it? We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Oh, now the good old union has come in here to clear. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
During the break, I got an email from Keith. And again, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. He said the term associates and talking about the Walmart people has always been a problem with me. I think as long as they are referred to as associates instead of employees, the union will never get through to these groups of employees. And yeah, you look at that and to be honest, it is a nice little spin. You know, I had a friend who not too long ago changed jobs, and he said, you know, the job he was in, all they kept giving me was a better title. I never got any raises, I never got health care or any retirement, but I always had a neat title. They always gave me I was the director of this, or you know, the special assistant to this, or you know, always something to, you know, write down on paper that looked quite impressive. And, you know, we would go to, you know, like parties and stuff, and he would say, well, I'm the director of special intelligence for this. And you go, well, what do they pay you? Well, $12 an hour. But again, you know, they got a really neat title, kind of like associate. So it's kind of an inclusive thing. You got to give them credit. The Walmart people are very good at marketing. So it is a very good thing, I guess. You know, the people who work there kind of get the shaft. And we, the taxpayers, we pick up the cost of health care for a lot of them, a lot of folks. Which, you know, again, you know, it goes back to this idea that there's part of me that believes. You take away all of the safety net. You do away with unemployment. You do away with, health care. You do away with all of that stuff from the public sector, and you allow people to fall to the bottom, collapse, and then from there you build them back up. with strong connections to each other. Maybe we have to hit rock bottom before people come back together. Because if you go back to the Great Depression, it was only then that you really saw large numbers of people going, we better figure out how to insulate ourselves from all the problems that are going on. Maybe collective bargaining is the way. Which, again, is probably why we're seeing all of these attacks. Because, you know, they want to make sure that the ground level is secure for them. Because if it's against the law, maybe they won't do it. And I find it interesting that they want to make it against the law and they want to take the rights away, like somehow them taking away is going to delegitimize people coming together. Amazing stuff. Anyway, a couple of reports from our friends at Hypocrisy Watch. And one of the, this caught my eye. Evidently, the governor isn't letting anyone into his press conferences that doesn't have media credentials. Now, when Rendell was there, if you didn't have media credentials, anybody could go as long as you fit in the room. I went to a couple of Rendell's press conferences, didn't have media credentials. I do now, but I didn't then. So I will be attending Mr. Corbett's press conferences because I've got media credentials. I don't know what that makes me any better than anybody else, but I went and filled out the form, and I suggest then everybody go fill out the form, pay your $10, and become a media outlet, and go to his press conferences, because evidently he doesn't want the public there. Evidently he wants only a select few, maybe the folks that he can control, and who knows? Who knows what he's talking about in those press conferences?
According to our buddy Eric Epstein, this is the first time a governor has ever done that. Do you realize that he can preclude members who were duly elected by their representative, whether a state senator or state representative, from attending these press conferences? Something wrong with that.
Well, they are his press conferences, after all. Anyway, it was 4 weeks ago today. 41,000 Pennsylvanians woke up and lost their health insurance, thanks to Governor Corporate's decision to end the adult basic program. You'll remember Auditor General Jack Wagner called for statewide hearings on how the Tobacco Settlement Fund, which used to pay for adult basic, is being spent. Of course, since Corbett's plans to eliminate the fund altogether, he can create a new program to reward his favorite businesses. Wagner's plan doesn't seem much like it's going to get any traction. And the insurance industry, the Blues, have donated big bucks to Corbett's campaign and also to the Republican Party as well to avoid having to pay and having the responsibility. All of which leaves us back where we started. No gubernatorial leadership, no health care, but lots of uninsured people and lots of insurance industry profits, while Pennsylvania taxpayers are footing the bill. You know, sometimes you just got to wonder. You got to wonder what the priorities we have in this state. I'm increasingly frustrated the fact that this governor has chosen to make the cuts that he's made in favor of tax breaks for big corporations.
The irony, we're talking about Walmart. That was one of the big stories today. And even though it's a little bit different than what the governor's doing, it's part of one of the big problems in our state, in Walmart. If I remember the figures, and this is going back, but it just brings back bad memories, in the state of Texas, in the state of Tennessee, and in the state of Pennsylvania, where Walmart has a lot of their stores, Walmart employees, there were more Walmart employees than any other employee applying for state aid and health care. You and I are paying for their health care. Now, they do offer a plan, but a lot of them can't afford what they're paying. So Walmart actually holds classes to teach them how to sign up for health care assistance. And you and I wind up paying for it, the biggest corporation in America.
But we get low prices. We get selection. We get to buy stuff from China or from China.
Whoopee.
Did you see that show on ABC? That I think it was Diane Sawyer who did it, where they went into a house and the people allowed them to take everything out of the house that wasn't made in the U.S. And by the time they ended up emptying the house, there was like one vase left in the house. That was it. Everything else had been stripped out. Even the clothes. I mean, everything out of the house except one stinking vase. And then they went and they filled the house with similar stuff, but all that stuff was made in the U.S. And when they came back and figured it out, it had only cost a couple of bucks more to buy all stuff made in the U.S. And I got to be honest, I don't know where they found a lot of the stuff, because I didn't think a lot of the products that the consumer products were made here anymore. I think they need to do a better job of getting the word out and a better job of advertising, because I do believe most people, would buy products made in the U.S. because, you know, the job you may be saving is your own. We need, at this time especially, to create an environment where we're supporting each other. And you know, I'm just amazed at the apathy and this mentality that's been ingrained in us for at least the last 30 years. You know, most of my life, that it's hooray for me and the heck with everybody else. I got mine. I don't care about anybody else. And the whole Walmart thing is, you know, I got lower price. I don't care about those workers. I don't care about the people in China or India or Guatemala or who knows where, or the conditions that they toil under. And, you know, what I find funny, and again, I want to go back to that Cumberland County, I think it was like one of these 9-12 groups had all the people running for county commissioner come together, and they were talking about collective bargaining. And the Republicans were all, well, I think it's the scourge of the earth, and I think we should do away with it. We don't need such a thing. We used to need it back when my, you know, great-grandfather was dying in the mines. We used to need it. They were okay then. But now, no. And yet we still have 50,000 people who die of industrial deaths every year, illnesses every year. We have people who are hurt on the job. We have people who are killed on the job every year. We've got conditions where people are having their wages stolen from them. You name it, it's still going on. The problem is we've done such a good job of convincing ourselves that, oh, that doesn't happen anymore. That's the old days. It's the old days when the boss was a tyrant. And it's the old days when the boss used to steal from the paychecks. And it's the old days when women were hit on by their bosses and said, hey, you know, if you don't come around, I may find somebody else. That was the old days. That doesn't happen anymore. And the reality is, when you open your eyes and you look around, you go, it still happens. Not much has changed. We just like to kid ourselves and think that things have changed. And, you know, I look at those kids today in Kutztown who stood out on the lawn there and had their voices heard. Brave, brave kids. Because they're going to need to be. They're going to need to be joined together. They're going to need to be in solidarity. Because at the end of the road, if they lose, it's a death sentence.
It doesn't matter if you're young and you're a college student or you're unemployed or you're a worker. It's your country, and those young people better start fighting. They better start fighting because they're going to be here a long time.
So if you missed any portion of the program, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, download the podcast from there. Again, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio WI.
Thanks, of course, always go to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.